Call the meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. My name is Representative Paul Gardner. I'm the subcommittee chair for the Drinking Water Source Protection Subcommittee of the Environmental Finance Division of the House Finance Committee. That's a mouthful. This is our first meeting, and I wanted to thank the folks here in Dakota County for hosting us today. Before we get started, I just wanted to do a little introductions. I'm getting used to the consoles here. This is a lot fancier than we have in the legislature, but I wonder if I could just have the representatives, starting with Representative Scalzi, just introduce themselves quickly.
I'm Representative Beth Scalzi, and I come from Little Canada, Minnesota, which is the other side of the metro area from here, about 6 miles north of the state capital. And I represent Little Canada, Vadnais Heights, part of Shoreview, and part of Roseville. And I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you. I'm Representative Denny McNamara. I live over in Hastings, so I live in Dakota County here. I'm glad to have everybody here, especially glad to have the county here to present this morning. I need to apologize. We have a veterans event at our Hastings High School. Governor Plenty is coming at 9:30 this morning to address our high school about veterans issues, so I'm going to be slipping out of here very shortly, but I apologize to the county. I hope to catch most of your presentation, and certainly we'll look over the stuff. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Representative Dennis Osmond. I have the district that's directly to the east here, just actually across the street, and so I really welcome you to this area. I'm very interested in listening to these reports, and also want to recognize that my senator, Chris Gerlach, is also here this morning. Appreciate that, Chris, Senator.
Representative Jean Wagini of South Minneapolis, and thanks to Dakota County for hosting this, and we hope we recognize also Representative Liz Holford, who joined us in Jenna Sandy.
You beat me to the... The quick story, Representative Holberg is from Lakeville, I believe, in Dakota County. And I'm sorry, I don't know Senator Gerlach, but welcome. Representative Mason?
Right, my glasses are focused.
Is here from Eagan and Burnsville. And I believe right here is in Representative, my twin brother, Representative Morgan. We get mistaken all the time. He's teaching today at school, so he couldn't be here today. Representative Tingelstad is also an ex officio member. She's with the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources, the LCCMR, which is considering some really interesting proposals as they relate to drinking water. Representative Magnus, I think he's from Slayton. He's working on the 35W Contingency Committee this morning, so he couldn't be here today. And Representative Moe had to be up in his district in the Bemidji area. We do want to work in a timely fashion today. We need to be done by noon today. We've got some folks on the Solid Waste Working Group who are also going to some sites in Dakota County today, including the SKB Industrial Waste Landfill in Rosemount and the RT Compost Site in Empire Township. So we want to make sure we stay on time. Let me just also mention we've got a couple of staffers here today. My legislative assistant for the committee, Jennifer Hall, Jenna Duenhager, who's the committee administrator, Janelle Taylor, who's the nonpartisan House researcher there, and I'm sorry, is it Mr. Goodley?
Mark Nicely.
Nicely, I'm sorry.
Republican Research.
Thank you. And then Eileen Shore from DFL House Research, and Jim Heinholz, who's the fiscal analyst for the Environmental Finance Committee. Some of us carpooled, but we should have gotten a bus, I think. A little bit about the purpose of the subcommittee. Over the last couple of years, there's just been a lot of data generated about water, and I've got, that's my notebook of just all the reports that have been issued over the last couple of years from a variety of sources, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Environmental Quality Board, the MPCA, the DNR, not to mention counties, and it's kind of overwhelming, and some of the information is really spot on, and some of it relates to other things and includes some stuff about drinking water, but we haven't really had a thorough vetting in recent years about some of the information that's been coming out about drinking water. There had been a legislative water committee that for budget reasons had been decommissioned, I guess. And there's been a lot of focus on our surface waters for good reason over the last few years, and now that the Clean Water Legacy Bill went through over the last few years, we have now had the time to look at some other water resources. Among all the things in this book, I think one of the more compelling reports is going to be presented by our first presenters here, David Swenson and Jill Trescott. From Dakota County. I should move. But I found this a very compelling report because I think it's the first countywide survey of private wells in particular, and I think that's something that we've all wished for, and after I read it, I kind of thought, boy, I should be careful what I wish for because there's some stuff in there that's making me a little uncomfortable. So why don't I have you start, and then we'll follow with the folks from Met Council and then the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. And money. There's a sign-in sheet. Is it on this desk?
Yeah, it's on the folder.
So when you're done, if you don't do it, we'll chase you down and get you to sign in. Can everybody see over my head?
The mouse is a little sticky here.
There you go.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name, I don't know if we're taping or not, but if you could state your name and title for the committee, that would be great.
Great. Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to address this subcommittee. Drinking water is a very precious commodity in Dakota County. We take it very seriously, and I'm sorry that Representative McNamara has to leave. We'll try to talk quickly, but it can only go so fast. Your point right away of a lot of data we're going to address, because that is a big issue. My name is David Swenson, as you know, and I am the acting director of the Dakota County Water Resource Department. I'd like to point out a few of our staff that have come along, and we have Greg Kunat, our Physical Development Division Director, and Michelle Beeman, our Environment and Natural Resource Director, George Kinney, our Contaminated Site Supervisor, Vanessa DeMuth, Geologist and Project Manager, Jeff Lears, our lead in the well program, and our co-speaker is Jill Trescott, Environmental Research. With that, I think, there we go. A couple of remarks on what we're going to cover. We're going to talk a little bit about philosophy. I'm going to very briefly talk about state and local responsibilities. Then I'm going to launch into some Dakota County programs, some noteworthy state efforts, and then some recommendations in general for more sustainable groundwater and drinking water. Our philosophy is quite simple. We have about five sort of leading concepts, and that's make policy and decisions based on science. And that's easy to say, but hard to do, because science oftentimes gets confusing and mixed up with terms and theories that are difficult. So really, I should augment this by saying, and make it understandable to those people that can use the information to make policy. Collaboration with state, federal, and local agencies is a must these days. There's way too much going on for one agency to do it all, and it's just like in life. Sometimes you need a little help. Act for the long term. Focus on sustainability. What will the future bring? In fact, in Dakota County, one of our biggest limitations for future development is water. How do we know where we can develop if we don't know where the water is? And who's competing for the water? We must treat groundwater and surface water as the same interconnected resource, because what's groundwater today will be surface water tomorrow, maybe groundwater the next day. And then make education and outreach activities an integral part of the program. And again, that's easy to say, and we all think we do it, but it's hard. It's hard. Dakota County is the third most populous county in the state of Minnesota, and 92% of our citizens drink groundwater. That's where they get the drinking water. The 8% that don't get water from St. Paul, which gets river water, as you know, and that's our citizens in West St. Paul and Mendota Heights. We have been very, very fortunate in Dakota County to have county commissioners and administrators that believe in water and in drinking water and in public health. And they've very readily agreed to support our programs and help us to find financing for them. So a great compliment goes out to our administrators and commissioners. Very briefly, drinking water rolls. They're all over the place. It's confusing, and I think that's an initiative that Met Council might be speaking to a little bit later today. I don't know. But very briefly, the cities administer public drinking water supplies. MDA, MDH focuses on the public health aspect, the well construction, and the contaminants that are found in the drinking water. Department of Ag is responsible for ag chemicals in the water. MPCA focuses on groundwater cleanup. DNR focuses on appropriating the water, so the municipalities need to appropriate the water from the state of Minnesota through the DNR. And then the county has sort of multi-city and private well issues. Our drinking water mission is to ensure that all people in Dakota County have a plentiful and safe supply of drinking water. When we look at our drinking water programs, we have four cornerstones, and they are regulation and prevention, monitoring and modeling, remediation and mitigation, and education and outreach. And all of our programs fit into this, and we'll go through this in due course, but without these fundamental cornerstones, we would just have a lot of programs hanging in limbo out there. I should say also, we've been very, very fortunate to have the level of technology and support at the county that we do, because it has allowed us to do many things with few people. And so we took to heed the statement, do more with less. If we look at regulation and prevention, I want to focus briefly on our well regulation program and our septic system program. The well regulation program has been delegated to the county from the state of Minnesota. The state of Minnesota has that authority. Annually, we typically light our permit about 200 well constructions. So we regulate the well program through permitting. We do about 250 well ceilings and over 500 registered wells. These are the wells that are monitoring usually spills, leaks, contamination in the groundwater. So we permit about 1,000 wells a year. No small task. We have one difference in Dakota County than the rest of the state. Upon property sale, we demand that the owner tests the well and notifies the new owner what the conditions are of the well. Because if it doesn't meet state standards, we say you can't sell the house. You have to be able to pass on clean drinking water. So if it doesn't meet the state standards, you have to fix it. You have to either put in a water treatment system or drill a new well. And if you don't, well, there's repercussions. You have to eventually go back and do it. We have a well-sealed grant program that we do in collaboration with our community development agency, Dakota County CDA. They supply us about $20,000 a year, and that helps us to seal about 18 of the most nasty, unused, unsealed wells in the county. And since 1993, we have helped, through this grant program, citizens to seal about 540 wells. It's a very successful program. Of course, everybody likes getting money. The septic system program, we have a county-wide ordinance for septic systems that was really constructed with the help of all those municipalities and cities that wanted to participate. This prevents as much as possible groundwater contamination. We also administer a an annual maintenance program, which reminds people to get their septic systems inspected or pumped out once every 3 years. This again helps prevent failure to the groundwater. And we do about 1,500 of those a year. Again, when a property is sold in Dakota County, the septic system must be inspected. And if it is failing, it has to be replaced, or that portion of it has to be replaced. We just simply have to stop the contamination of the groundwater by septic systems. This is just a quick example of rather a nice house, but you can see a drill rig in the front putting in a new well. Usually the wells are in front, and the septic systems are on the side or the back. And this is what happens if you don't disclose a property sale in Dakota County, that there is a well on the property. A developer ignored that part of the regulation, sold the property, brand new house. You can see the sod still being developed. And lo and behold, there's an old well house. And, well, we made them go back and seal it. Remember, I'll say this many times perhaps, but old unused wells are conduits for near surface contamination to zoom down to our more pristine aquifers. So you don't want to get in this mess. I'm going to move on briefly to monitoring and modeling, and I'm going to focus on groundwater modeling, both countywide and site-specific, and then a little bit about the MDH Wellhead Protection Program. At that point, Jill's going to come up and talk about some of our groundwater studies. First, a little background. This is a neat picture. It's a little confusing, but this is an elevation of the groundwater in Dakota County. And the darker areas are where the groundwater is lower, and the lighter areas are where it's higher. So it looks like this water is draped and flowing toward the river to the north and to the northeast. And it is. It's actually moving in that direction. Why is it moving in that direction? Well, partially gravity, but partially the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers take water out of our system. And as the water flows down to the rivers, the water moves down to Iowa, but it's got to be replaced. And so the groundwater moves to fill in the water that's being moved downstream. So that causes a uniform flow of the water to move in Dakota County, in this case, to the north, northeast, and east. Remember I said what's groundwater today is surface water, tomorrow is groundwater? Well, this is what it would look like. The uniform flow goes from right to left, basically, and you can see it going up into ponds that are in contact with the water table, going back out of the pond, into the ground, going into the river. And this can happen multiple times. So when we think of surface water protection and groundwater protection and drinking water protection, we must think holistically, because everything affects each other. This is a neat picture because it shows the municipal capture zones, municipal well capture zones. And aerially, you can see, particularly in the more built up east and northeast, there isn't a lot of space available where you can't impact a municipal well. These are capture zones that the source water protection folks at MDH are responsible for getting out there and getting the plans done. And we help the municipalities, and we review these for the state as well. But you can see, if we're looking out at year 2030, what's the competition going to be for our groundwater? Is it just a quality issue, or is it going to be quantity? Where can we put wells in the future that won't affect other wells? So these are some of the big challenges facing this county in the future. And at this point in time, I'm going to turn it over to Jill to talk about some more project-specific initiatives.
Good morning. I'm Jill Trescott, and I'm an environmental scientist with Dakota County. This map shows the location of private drinking water wells that are part of our ambient groundwater quality study. And the color of the dots on the map shows the nitrate results for those wells. It's a kind of stoplight pattern where red indicates the wells that are higher than the drinking water standard. The yellow is still at an elevated range. Green is at background levels, and blue is non-detect. The ambient groundwater quality study, Vanessa DeMuth of our staff started this program in 1999, and she and I work on it together. And every year the county tests private wells that have been selected around the county to be representative depths and also to represent the whole geographic area of the county. And the purpose is to evaluate the ambient or general condition of the water over an extended period of time. It is intended as a 20-year study. And this map is from 2005, but the results are typical of our year-to-year results. And there are there's several things that you can see from this. One is that up in the urbanized part of the county here, the county is about half suburban communities and half still farming communities. And up here in the urbanized areas, we actually have much less problems with these agricultural chemicals, as you can imagine, than we do in the rural part of the county. But another thing that you can see here is how heavily impacted we are by the soil and geological conditions. In the southwestern part of the county and the southeastern part of the county, both have very similar farming practices, and yet we have much worse drinking water conditions over in the eastern part of the county, where we have much sandier soils that allow for more contamination. There are a variety of geologic conditions. So it's not simply a matter of the farming practices, but what we really see is there's a tremendous influence from the conditions in the soil that the farmers are working with. This shows some of our results from our ambient study. These are from 2005 and 2006, but again, they are typical. And what we have found has been somewhat dismaying in that from 70 to 80% of the wells on a countywide basis do have detectable levels of nitrate and or agricultural pesticides. And as you can see, we have 20 to 25%, or 1 out of 5 to 1 out of 4 of the wells actually exceed a drinking water guideline, either for nitrate or for one of these pesticides or for both. A couple of other things that are notable about this study. One is that it has developed over time into one of the largest, most geographically concentrated collections of information about private drinking water well quality that we're aware of in the country, in terms of having years of data and how many wells are included in the study. In addition, this is a program that has been funded by Dakota County on its own through its environmental fund, although we work very closely with the Department of Health and with the Department of Agriculture in responding to the issues that have been raised with this. So they've been very involved with the program, but it is one that we fund on our own. I did want to touch briefly on the pesticides that have been detected in this program. We've been working with the United States Geological Survey, and their organic chemistry lab in Lawrence, Kansas, has done the analysis for pesticides and pesticide breakdown products. And what this shows is these are the different pesticides that have been detected. These are all herbicides that are used in corn and soybean farming. One thing that is the yellow color are the breakdown chemicals of those particular pesticides. The pinker color is a combination of parent compounds and breakdown chemicals. And then the red are the ones that exceed the drinking water standards. And so overwhelmingly what we do find are breakdown products, which are generally less toxic than the parent compounds. In the 2005 results, 78% of our wells had detectable pesticides in them, and 12% exceeded the drinking water standard, either for the pesticide known as cyanazine or Bladex, or for Alichlor, which is sold as Lasso. Another thing that's been very dismaying for us is that 62% of the wells had multiple pesticides in them, and we typically also see pesticides and nitrate together. And so while the the health information that we have is on individual compounds. We're very concerned that we see these mixtures of chemicals where the health effects are not well understood. But we are working with multiple agencies to address the nitrate and pesticide concerns that we have.
I had a quick question, and then I'll let that.
Certainly.
How did you pick the wells? And what's a typical well here?
What we have done is they were originally selected to represent a geographic area. That is, we would go through our version of the county well index, because we did want wells that we had geologic records for, construction records for, and would find a Prairie du Chien well, and then within 1,000 feet of that, also find a Jordan well and a quaternary or sand and gravel aquifer well. So what we have is, around the county, we have sets of, we've tried to have sets of three wells at different depths that are very close to each other. So, and then they are all private drinking water wells, and so we've invited the well owners to participate. It's entirely voluntary on their part. They're, you know, if someone says no, then we look for a different well.
If I could hold you up for a second, Representative Wagini had a question.
Yes, thank you. In the last legislative session, we changed the health risk limit for atrazine from 20 parts per billion, which was a terrible limit, to 3 parts per billion, which brought it down to the old 1992 standard.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think your atrazine would show up differently in terms of the red over drinking water standards using the 3 parts per billion? Or
no, the detections of atrazine that we've had have been below the 3 as well as below the 20. Yes.
Are you going to get to that where they were in general?
One thing that I should have mentioned, while this actually shows the nitrate result, that the pattern of distribution for pesticides is virtually identical to this,
mm-hmm.
where we have the high pesticides are in the same areas where we see the high nitrate. And in fact, we have an extremely high correlation, or, you know, relationship between the nitrate level in a particular well and the pesticides in a particular well. That we always find them together, or almost always find them together.
That's an important piece of information.
Thank you. It's been very significant, because with nitrate, there can be a lot of debate about where it can come from. It could come from manure, it could come from human waste, it can come from a wide variety of sources. And so what we've done in our area is, because we have this very strong relationship between pesticides that are only used for corn and soybean farming and nitrate, then we really have a smoking gun, where we say in our area, it's row crop agriculture is the issue. We do have other modeling and monitoring programs in the county, particularly focusing on groundwater and surface water interactions. This picture shows the installation of automatic sampling equipment at one of these sites. One of the things that we're looking at is nitrate transport in the Vermilion River, where what we are seeing is that one of the issues with nitrate, particularly say in the city of Hastings, is that nitrate gets into the groundwater in the upper reaches of the Vermilion River, then it comes into the river, and then the river itself leaks back into the groundwater in the Hastings area. And so that particular area seems to have not only its own nitrate, but it's getting nitrate from upstream as well. In addition, the Vermilion River stretches of it are a trout stream, and so we've been looking at the groundwater and surface water interactions to evaluate the impact of development on that trout stream in terms of temperature changes in both the groundwater and the surface water. And in addition, we conduct groundwater investigations and assessments at landfills and dump sites. A big part of our monitoring and modeling program is our well water testing program. As David mentioned, Dakota County has more stringent property transfer requirements than other parts of the state, where septic systems have to be brought into compliance and people have to have their well water tested for nitrate and coliform bacteria. And so we offer water testing on a fee basis on year-round. And particularly the nitrate and coliform bacteria are a big part of that. But in addition, with the help of the Department of Agriculture, they helped us identify a source for low-cost pesticide screening for well owners that's done by Heidelberg College in Ohio. And in addition, the Minnesota Department of Health has enabled us to work with their lab to offer PFC testing for well owners. But this picture is a free nitrate clinic, which we offer throughout the year. This one is with both Dakota County and Department of Agriculture staff at Simley High School in Invergrove Heights. And this is a way for well owners to get very basic screening for their water quality. Nitrate is the most common form of groundwater contamination here in Dakota County as well as other parts of the state. And so this has been a very popular service. And we always offer free clinics during the county fair, and then we have additional clinics throughout the year. Well, in order to address the problems that we identify through our monitoring and modeling programs, we do have extensive remediation and mitigation programs, which really fall into two areas. One is non-point source pollution prevention, which really focuses on the agricultural chemicals. And with those, it's our Hastings Area Nitrate Study, phases one, which was conducted from 1999 to 2003, and phase two, which is underway at this time. In addition to address point source pollution, we have a very active contaminated sites program that has been helping with the cleanup of Umore Park, the old Gopher Ordnance Works. They also conduct site investigations and to provide assistance for redevelopment of areas. And then they have special investigations, such as cleaning up lead acid battery disposal areas. The Hastings Area Nitrate Study Phase 1 was started in 1999 and conducted through 2003. It was funded as a Clean Water Partnership grant program, although we had additional support from a wide variety of agencies in the county as well. And the this shows the northeastern corner of Dakota County where the study was conducted. Because the city of Hastings has had steadily increasing nitrate levels in its water supply system. In fact, they recently had to install a $3 million treatment system to remove the nitrate from their drinking water. And so this was conducted to identify the sources and the extent of contamination in the area. In terms of extent, we sampled 150 private wells in Hastings and the surrounding townships, where we found that a quarter of the wells in that area exceeded the drinking water standard for nitrate, and another quarter of them were at an elevated level. So slightly more than half of them had elevated levels of nitrate. In addition, it was in this study where we first discovered this very strong relationship that we have between nitrate levels and pesticides in our area. Again, working with the U.S. Geological Survey. And so this was, as I mentioned, where we really felt that in this area we can really clearly say that the issues that we have are with row crop agriculture. But another thing that came out of this study was there was a confidential, extensive survey done by the Department of Agriculture of the farmers in the area. It's called a FANMAP, which is a Farm Nutrient Management Assessment Program. And as I said, it's a confidential survey, and it's also done in cooperation with the co-ops in the area. And so we get very good information about exactly what crops, how many acres a particular farmer has in different crops, what kind of livestock he's got, what kind of chemicals he's using, both in terms of fertilizers and pesticides, how he handles manure, everything like that. So what was happening that was that the farmers were really following the University of Minnesota's recommended best management practices, and yet we were having these contamination problems instead. And that's really enabled us to look at this not in terms of a finger-pointing exercise, but just to say, well, we have very sensitive geological conditions in this area, and that following the old best management practices hasn't been good enough, and so it's really given us an opportunity to work with the farming community, and at the same time, the university has reworked the way that it calculates best management practices, and so we've been working with our farmers to get the word out about really lowering the usage of nitrogen fertilizers in our area. One of the things that we looked at during this program, as David mentioned, we have a well regulation program that is delegated to us by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture that's been in place since 1989. And so we looked at wells that were constructed after we adopted our delegated well program and began regulating and inspecting well construction, and the wells that were constructed before then. And what we found was that the wells that were constructed before that program started had average nitrate levels of nearly 6 parts per million compared to the drinking water standard of 10, and where the wells that were constructed after we started our program had an average nitrate of 0. And so that really, to us, indicates that this has been an effective program in getting better quality wells installed, and that really do help protect the drinking water that people are getting in their houses. I had somebody ask me if this was the county's transit system, but it's actually a field day that we were conducting. As I mentioned, we are now working with our farming community in phase 2 of the Hastings Area Nitrate Study. This is funded in part by an EPA 319 grant through the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. In this case, there's a number of farmers and other agricultural professionals, crop consultants, are looking at one of our test sites in here in Dakota County. This is a program that, in addition to the 319 funding that we're receiving, we're getting extensive assistance from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. We have staff people from MDA who dedicate a significant portion of their time to actually working with farmers here in Dakota County. We've also funded a part-time person through the Extension Service. And there's very good cooperation where we work very closely with each other to make sure that we're not duplicating each other's efforts and we're not contradicting each other's efforts, that we are all working together on this. And this allows the Department of Agriculture to treat Dakota County as a kind of pilot program where we can bring some extra resources to problem solving that other communities can't, but that they can work on programs here that would then be applied in other parts of the state if they work here. These are some of the publications that we've sent out to our farming community, talking about, in particular, nitrogen and nitrogen fertilizer management. And now David is going to talk some more about our the point source pollution programs.
Before I launch into that, I want to put an exclamation point on two things that Jill talked about, because I think it they're important enough. Regarding the ambient groundwater quality study, our silent partners are our citizens, and without the partnership of our citizens for this, we would not be able to do the kind of work. So the buy-in by our citizens and the interest that our citizens have taken are very important. When one of our citizens decides that they might want to drop out of that sampling program, we have Vanessa DeMuth bring them flowers, and that usually helps. The other exclamation point I want to make is on the HANS program. The HANS 1 program from 1999 to 2003 identified the problem, identified the severity and the public health aspect of the problem, and it gave us a clue as to how to try to fix it. We didn't feel comfortable just saying, here, state, you go fix it. What we did is we got another grant, and we said, we're going to try to fix it, but we need help. We need collaboration. And that collaboration, Jill's a little modest, involves not only the Department of Ag and to some degree the Department of Health, but also the USDA and also the SWCD, Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District, and also the University of Minnesota Extension Services. We had to bring in the real experts in this, knowing that we saw the problem. We kind of knew how to do it, but we needed these people that had the expertise, and that's where the collaboration really comes in. Thank you. I'm going to move on now to contaminated sites. These are considered point source for contamination, while Jill talked about non-point source, and you see the juxtaposition. Most of these sites that you see up there, and there's 2,100 sites we've identified, I should say, they range from small farm dumps to industrial waste, leaks, spills, and dumps. But they're almost all in the urbanized area, the north area. So we have a very clear distinction in Dakota County. The urban area has the non-point source, or the ag chemicals, and the urban area has the point source. And so the types of groundwater contamination are completely different. And so that's why we're interested in, because these are sources that could leak bad stuff into the ground, into the water, and cause a problem for drinking water. And it has. It has. I must tell you that only about 400 of those are currently hitting our radar, not all 2,100.
What does that mean, only 400 are hitting your radar? The rest of them are taken care of? Or?
No. The rest of 400 are I think George refers to it as our top priority 400, being that we can't get to all 2,100 at the same time. And also, we recognize that some of these more farm dumps and more generic dumps don't warrant the type of immediate investigation that some of the higher priority dumps might. But one of them that's on our list is the old Umore Park. This is the area that the University of Minnesota has traded for the Gopher football stadium. And being that this was a Gopher Ordnance Works that made smokeless gunpowder in the late stages of World War II, this is a serious amount of contamination or potential contamination. And this represents, I think it's about 7,500 acres or more. And Dakota County staff probably knows the most about it of anybody, and we've been working with the PCA, who's been working with the University of Minnesota and the Corps of Engineers for investigation and cleanup. And we're very proud of our work here, and we've spent a lot of time working at this.
Sure. Representative Osmond.
Just a little clarification with regard to the 3,000 acres that's been dedicated to the Wildlife Management Area and Trade Bruce Stadium. Is that the heavily contaminated area, or is it actually the lands north of that piece?
It's the, Representative Osmond, it's the land north of that piece. The land south of that piece is in investigation right now, and it does not have the same potential, but the land north of it. And then all the land south of it that are not part of the trade but are part of the Umore Park have miscellaneous dumps, wells, that sort of thing. Yes, thank you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, because I just wanted my colleagues to know we didn't go try to trade contaminated land.
No, sir. No, sir.
Duly noted. Please continue.
The one of the new ways of thinking is demonstrated here by the Wren Meadowlark Low Impact Development Site. This is a site where our Dakota County CDA wanted to put in 8 townhouses for medium income citizens, and they hired a consulting engineering firm to do more of a classical, conventional, traditional stormwater ponding removal system, which involved installing a big ponding area down here in the lower left and a small pond area in the upper right to take care of the excess stormwater needs. We discovered when we were doing an environmental review that the area in yellow really represented an old dump, and so we didn't really want ponds to be put in old dumps. Also, the infiltration channel in the upper left, after the water infiltrated, would pass downward through groundwater movement through the old dump, thereby picking up more contaminants and bringing them into the groundwater, drinking water systems, or into the Vermilion River. So an alternate plan by SW's Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District and our Water Resources Department, our water engineer, and CDA was to put in more porous pavement, number one. Number two, all the little green blobs represent rain gardens, so infiltration can be sustained on a more local, smaller area. And the need for that big pond is now, you know, we don't need it anymore. The small pond is still there for excessive stormwater events. But this is a new approach to low-impact development for the future. And it also deals with some environmental justice issues at the same time. Lead's getting a lot of attention, and rightfully so. And part of the contaminated sites' efforts are to remove lead from the environment. And this is a case where lead-acid battery casings were disposed of, and we've discovered it. Oftentimes it's discovered through a development and road building, and then we come in and help the developer or the landowner deal with it. This comes in many shapes and sizes. Sometimes they're chopped up, put into septic systems. Sometimes they're just disposed of in big old pits. But of course, there is a surface water public health issue here. A surface public health issue with direct contact to the lead. And some people believe that there's a potential for groundwater contamination through the lead.
Representative Allen?
Yes, quick question on that. The assistance that you're able to provide, is that in the form of just technical assistance? You're able to provide for funding for cleanup, or what is that?
We primarily provide technical assistance. It's the responsibility of the property owner to do the remediation. However, at times we will consider participating in the remediation cost, depending on the situation.
Okay.
Thank you. That moves us on to education and outreach. We're involved in a lot of the standard education and outreach, like the county fair and web and children's water festival, realtor seminars and publications. But some of the things that we can do are Blue Thumb wetland health programs and specialized communication. What's important about wetlands? Well, wetland health evaluation is important to keep our wetlands healthy, so we not only treat surface water and stormwater, but that treats the water so that when it infiltrates the groundwater, it's a lot cleaner product. And the Blue Thumb training is for homeowners, so they can learn how to put in rain gardens that treats water runoff, so that not only do we have cleaner surface water again like the wetlands, but when it infiltrates into the ground, it's cleaner for the groundwater. And of course, it keeps contaminants out of our stormwater ponds, which are used for recreation and wildlife. We also have beefed up our communication planning on every level, but just as Jill had pointed out, particularly with our nitrate and pesticides, which become emerging issues, as well as we've tagged on to the Department of Health's efforts for the 3M chemicals. And this is an important part of the future. This is an example, one of the brochures we put out. Here we tell the people, there are problems, this is what you do to check for them, and this is what to do if you have them. And it's a fairly comprehensive approach to having the citizens help themselves rather than relying on government. And citizens think that government is a solution for their drinking water problems.
You know, I just have a question. I've noticed you talked about nitrates. Thank you, Chair. And pesticides. Do you use the word pesticides and herbicides at the same time, or what are we talking about with herbicides and which pesticides are?
We use it as a generic. Overall term. Thank you. This is what it looks like when it's all done, and it looks like like it's pretty confusing, but everything is interrelated. That's the point I'm making here, and that we can't just look at things in isolation at times, but things are related. And I also will tell you, it took 11 years to build up our program to get to this more comprehensive level. I want to go over some very quickly some noteworthy efforts with the Department of Ag, Health, and PCA. And with regard to the Department of Ag, I want to commend the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Dan Stoddard in that division has been extremely helpful in helping us to develop new programs for looking at the management of pesticides and nitrate. And also, this collaborative effort has saved us a lot of time and energy and has reduced the duplicative efforts that would have otherwise taken place. We appreciate the interest that they have taken in our agricultural issues here. With regard to the Department of Health, the Environmental Health Division, currently headed up by John Linkstein, has been nothing but extremely helpful to us in our collaborative efforts. We've played a big role in the Source Water Protection Unit for Municipal Wellhead Protection Planning. The Well Management Unit, headed up by Dan Wilson, has been extremely supportive and collaborative in our well program efforts. And the Health Risk Assessment and Toxicology area has helped us do health risk assessments for a lot of our drinking water test work that we've done. I want to commend John Linkstein and his staff for their communication work on the 3M chemical issue. I think once they caught on, it proved pretty effective in Dakota County, and I'm guessing in Washington as well. With regard to the PCA, we commend the PCA for their new Emerging Issues Work Team, and we have a similar team here, not as rigorous as the PCA, but we believe that that type of thinking is what's needed for the future. With regard to the septic system program, we think that Gretchen Sable is doing a great job trying to get the new rules through, and her leadership is just stellar. We also commend the legislature for passing the new straight pipe legislation for sewer systems last year. We think that was a wonderful addition. The last thing I want to commend is Met Council, who's coming up next, for their work in water supply. And we're very serious about water supply and water reuse, which are two things that Met Council is working on. And one of our commissioners, Commissioner Harris, sits on the advisory committee, and our hydrologist is on one of the technical committees. And we take this very seriously. And they were the impetus for us contracting with the USGS to look at a companion water supply study for Dakota County. I'm going to talk a little bit here and finish up in the next couple of minutes about six recommendations for sustainable drinking water in Minnesota.
To begin with, we believe it's important to protect both groundwater and surface water to best serve the public interest. The majority of people in Dakota County, as in the whole state of Minnesota, rely on groundwater for their drinking water supplies. And while it's safe to say that the public considers protecting drinking water to be a core function of government, the state has seen in recent years has put a lot of resources into surface water, in many cases to the detriment of groundwater protection. It's important to protect both groundwater and surface water. Their problems are different but interrelated. Second, support long-term solutions to groundwater problems. Groundwater contamination problems often take decades to develop, and they certainly take decades to clean up. And so it's while the LCCMR programs are terrific for what they are almost always short-term projects in terms of just covering a couple of years. And so it's important to also create long-term solutions and make sure that the resources are in place in the long term for addressing these kind of problems. Next is to address current issues, such as the nitrate and pesticide issues that we've talked about, the PFC issues that you're certainly aware of. We urge the state to be more ambitious in addressing these by expanding the resources available for environmental investigations, for outreach and education to raise public awareness of where their drinking water comes from and how to protect it, in resources for laboratory analysis, which can be something of a choke point now with conducting investigations on the state level, and also additional resources for risk assessments. And in addition, to prepare for new emerging issues, we talk about things like PFCs, as there are a whole, we become aware of contaminants like PFCs or like the pesticide breakdown products that we've talked about, because laboratory capabilities are getting more sensitive all the time. And our ability to detect chemicals is developing faster than our ability to respond to those chemicals to determine whether they are a health risk or if they're a risk to the environment. But things like pesticide degradants and PFCs are not the end of the story. New chemicals will be found. They're not a one-time bad deal. Finding these kind of chemicals is going to be the new normal. And so Minnesota is already establishing itself as a national leader in emergency preparedness. I think we saw that with the I-35 bridge collapse. And we would like to see this state also establish itself as a leader in responding to the emerging issues that are being found in drinking water.
And the last two, to follow up on what Jill was saying, is additional resources for education and outreach. For the emerging issues, in particular, the ones that we've seen lately, as well as informing both users and consumers of what the issues are and the potential solutions, and go to that next stage of solutions. It's amazing how many people out there still don't know where their drinking water comes from. It really is. Also, facilitate better communication and data sharing between state and local agencies. Representative Gardner put this big stack of papers up on the counter there. And
what?
we have our own representative. And you know what? The PCA does, the NDA says, everybody does. And without better sharing of this, we can't possibly make the type of progress we need, and our efforts are going to be duplicated. And I know why we do it, because we spend so much money and so much care developing that data that we don't want to share it because we're afraid somebody else is going to mess it up. But we have to really find a better way of sharing it. And I think the state is, in many cases, with their new Oracle databases, trying to do it, but I would like to see it a little bit quicker. With that, we have a little bit of time left if you should have any further questions.
Yeah, before we do questions, I wanted to correct my error. I said that Representative Morgan represented Apple Valley. He's in Burnsville, and Representative Shelley Medora represents this part of Apple Valley, and she had another commitment. And a little bird told me that it's Representative Mason's birthday today. Is that right? Happy 39th birthday.
I'd like to add one more thing, too, that we'd like to thank the City of Apple Valley for providing this.
Yes.
Council chambers.
Thank you very much. I was also going to mention, too, that Representative Julie Bunn is heading up a work group of the Health Policy Committee on the Health Department oversight for PFCs, too, and she's aware of this committee, and I'm sitting on hers as well so that we can keep track. Okay, let's get the queue going. Representative Leganis? Okay.
Thank you. First, I just want you to know how much I appreciate what you're doing, because the state needs a model, and you are it. I had a question about the monitoring and modeling. When you were talking about well testing, you talked about a low-cost ag screening tool, and I was just wondering if you could, and that you were sending to Ohio to have I just wish you'd expand on that a little bit.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, we what we were looking for, the testing that we do as part of our ambient study for pesticides is it's very expensive to begin with, but it's also research testing that's not available to the general public. But because people have had concerns about pesticides, we did want to find some opportunity for private well owners to have their water tested. And this was a concern that was shared by the State Department of Agriculture. And so the Heidelberg College in Ohio offers a screening test for pesticides, and we will help homeowners. It's $50, and it detects, it will say on a yes-no basis if a well has the most commonly found pesticides in our area, which are, not to get too technical, but basically the alachlor family and the atrazine family of chemicals. And so it will say yes or no whether there are pesticides in somebody's water, and it gives some indication of the level, but it's not something that can really be compared to a drinking water standard. But it is $50, and which is which we consider fairly affordable. And the information is available on the Department of Agriculture website as well as on our own.
It's usually advertised that it's just impossible to test for ag chemicals, so we might as well not bother because it's just too expensive. But this is a good clue to us about something that can become more widespread. So that's good.
It's a good general indicator. Yeah. So it is helpful to citizens.
Sometimes all you need to start with.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Representative Clark, welcome.
Thank you. First of all, let me apologize for being late. I've seen a lot of your city this morning. I was traveling all over. I want to thank the very kind...
She's on that tractor they showed.
Very kind woman at the front desk who finally spent maybe the last 50 minutes helping me go from street to street. So I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to have you down correctly. So you maybe have covered a number of things, but I understand we're here because you're a model, and I heard Representative McGinnis say that, and I'm so glad. And I have a couple of questions. One that just came from the testimony you gave about needing to go to Ohio to get ag chemicals tested. My goodness, why are we not making this available in our own Minnesota Department of Health? That's my first question. I mean, I'm not asking you about the politics of that. I'm just asking you, whatever you want to say about it.
Ms. Fiske.
In fact, one of the things that we have suggested is additional resources for laboratory analysis in the state, because the Department of Ag and the Department of Health have a lovely new laboratory facility that they share, but... It's our belief that it needs additional staff.
Well, let me just say there will be legislation requiring the Minnesota Department of Health to do exactly what you're asking. As far as I chair the Public Health Committee, and that, mm-hmm. to me it's ridiculous that people have to go to Ohio, send water to Ohio to get tested from Minnesota. I just don't find that acceptable.
Representative Clark, I should mention that both the Department of Health and Department of Ag have boosted up their abilities to analyze for some of these chemicals recently. They're not at the level that we're recommending, but they have added instrumentation, but they still need more help. So they have started, and I think we'd like to see it continues what we're seeing. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. The other question I had was a more general one based on your last comment. Is it Trescott?
Yes.
When you were talking about all of the, trying to keep up with all of the range of chemicals that are coming out, and how in the world does research keep up with what needs to be tested for, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the precautionary principle.
Yes.
Which basically says chemicals cannot be released they cannot be produced and released into communities until they've proven that they're not harmful. And this is a principle that's used in Europe and other civilized countries, and I'm just wondering, you know, we have not gotten anywhere with trying to look at that precautionary principle here, and I'm just wondering if you might have some comments on the need for that, and you know, any suggestions you would have for trying to go that direction. How it would help you, I guess, with your work.
I think that for one thing, it would be so many chemicals are already in the environment. I think, you know, I've seen the figure 87,000 artificial chemicals that are already in marketplace. And so legislation requiring pre-screening might be helpful for future chemicals, particularly whole new areas like nanotechnology where there's so many unknowns. It still wouldn't do anything about the existing chemicals. I think that the kinds of issues that are coming out, as David mentioned, the Pollution Control Agency has recently established an emerging issues work team that we're very encouraged by. And the list of issues they're looking at is, I think, it's probably 24 different whole families of chemicals, and including nanotechnology and endocrine disruptors and things like that. That there is something of a catch-22 in that the state does not develop drinking water standards for a chemical until it's been detected in the groundwater, but they don't look for things in the groundwater unless it has a drinking water standard. And so there is a certain randomness to what does get a lot of times something has to be found independently before it will be fully investigated. So that's an issue.
Certainly, we've suggested that maybe there could be more work done in the health risk assessment area of public health to take a look at these emerging issues before they become, you know, so critical, and to try to establish health risk limits before these chemicals hit the pavement.
I just want to say, in the last legislative session, we did require the Department of Health to, I think, establish standards for the top 10 contaminants, I believe it was. Every 10? Was it 10? Yeah.
Yes, and reset the PFC.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good.
So I don't know, we haven't had an update on that, but maybe Representative Guinness knows more about that.
I know that in Representative Bunn's working group, that the Department of Health is updating on where they're at on the PFCs, too. But for Representative Guinness.
Yes, I would. Talk to us a little more about that catch-22 that you just mentioned. I think that is significant, and it's a significant issue that this committee is going to have to talk about.
Why don't you start it out from where you left off, and we'll see where it goes.
I believe it's part of the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989, but I'm not entirely sure about that. But essentially, that when a contaminant is found in Dakota County groundwater, then the Minnesota Department of Health, if they're requested, will establish a health risk limit for that chemical, and which is all very well. But the monitoring policies of the various state agencies have generally been not to look for chemicals unless there is some kind of health concern for them. And so there's not a, on the state level, there are not wide-ranging reconnaissance efforts to look for these kind of emerging issues. They have typically come out of work done by other agencies, such as through the university or through the United States Geological Survey, where they've identified that something seems to be a problem, and then the state will pick it up. But as I said, there currently isn't a research component of looking for possible contaminants, just looking around to see what might be out there.
I'm Representative Vigenius. We can't always analyze for everything, and so I think what MDH is trying to do is pick and choose what are the most likely candidates. I think what we have done here in Dakota County is we've broadened our scope, mm-hmm. and we have said, well, if this is here, there could be this here. And a good example is our work in cyanazine, which is a discontinued pesticide and was discontinued for good reason. And we're finding it in our drinking water above health limits. And when we go to MDH and say, wow, here's an emerging issue, we found this, what do you know about it, what can you tell us about it? And basically, they haven't been looking for it because they hadn't thought they would find it. And so that's sort of an example of this catch-22. So how do we get out of it? How do we become more aware of the chemicals, and how do we brace ourselves and prepare our citizens for this is the big question.
I think if we, and let me just test you on if we became more aware, or we had a policy of becoming more aware, and we were deliberate about it, then it seems to me we might be more cautious about policies that might allow stuff to get in our drinking water. Do you think that might help in making us, just as a general state, more cautious? Which we probably should be. We're not being cautious right now.
I completely agree. Yes. Like we talked about, it's got to come from the user as well as the consumer. Mm-hmm. That's where the... Yeah.
Well, I think that's something that we in this committee can spend some time discussing.
I got a couple of questions worked up, and I'll save them for last. Representative Scalzi, were you raising your hand?
Yes, on your slide regarding the Hastings Area Nitrate Study, and we're looking at, and I'm assuming it's the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989, because we're looking at wells constructed before delegated well program and wells constructed after 1989. And coming from an area that has lots of old private drinking water wells, one of which is mine, I'm just wondering, when you say there's bad wells and there's good wells and old wells and new wells, and I look at the nitrate levels, what is there a simple way you can explain what an old bad well would be as opposed to a new one?
There are two basic problems with older wells. The first one is that they're just not deep enough. That if they're drawing from an area that has contaminated water, it's going to have contaminated water in it. And I also have an old well that I just replaced a well that was about 20 feet deep with a well that was about 300 feet deep. So the shallow wells in the area can be very shallow indeed. The other thing is with the well construction, a properly constructed well has a grout around it that it not only holds the well casing in place, but it serves as a sealer to prevent any contamination from the surface from basically running down the outside of the well and getting into the well. So a well itself can be a source of contamination. That's why well ceilings are so important to us with old wells, because it's a very direct conduit down to the drinking water, and that well itself can be the way that contamination gets down there.
I have a couple questions. How much did it cost to do the ambient groundwater quality survey?
As with many things, the costs have gone up over time. The county currently spends about $50,000 a year on it.
Okay. I'm just trying to get, but it is a model, I think, and let's say the two counties I represent, Anoka and Ramsey, were to do something like that, I wanted to get a scope of it. But to do the ongoing monitoring, you're saying it.
And the county is committed to a 20-year program, so that's quite a commitment.
Mm-hmm. And you said it comes from the Environmental Fund?
Mm-hmm.
And does that come from fees, from dedicated fees from your two big landfills?
Yes.
Okay.
Predominantly, yes.
Or solid waste, sorry. You have this perverse advantage because other counties don't have landfills, and so they have to subsidize their incinerators on the hauler bills. But you have got two big landfills, and you can extract the hauler fees.
It's an appropriate use.
Yeah, oh, I agree.
Sometimes we say garbage made us what we are today.
Okay. I just went crazy with a highlighter on your report a couple of weeks ago because I found it so interesting, and I was just going to state a couple of things. Here's one: that 61% of wells tested in the survey contained pesticides and their breakdown products. although none of them was above the drinking water standard, I guess.
That was true at the time that that report was published, but since then we have had wells that were over the drinking water standard for pesticides.
And 52% of them had wells with multiple pesticides. I heard you say 62, but maybe I wrote it down wrong. And that the actual percentage of private wells that exceed drinking water standards is 18-26% for nitrate.
Nitrate, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying that kind of freaked me out. And also the 20-30% of groundwater in the county is unsafe for human consumption. Is that because it's from those contaminated sites, so they exceed the drinking water standard, or it's too hard, or... And I'm just trying to extrapolate.
No, it is predominantly for the nitrate and pesticides in the water.
It is really freaking me out now.
The nitrate really affects infants more than adults. Adults take a lot more, but it's the infant that we're concerned about.
Well, here's the big question. What happens with, what do the homeowners say when you give them the results? I mean, they took a pretty big leap in saying, you know, I will volunteer to do this, but I know in my district, we've got some people with vinyl chloride in their wells, and it doesn't red tag the wells yet, but it doesn't make them feel very good, and they kind of go through these seven stages of grief, you know, on groundwater, and I mean, it's kind of hard to deal with, and the issue seems to be so overwhelming you can't point to any particular thing. You can sort of talk about the pesticides, but you can't just stick a cork and ask, some of that stuff will be there for 20 years. What do they do?
Start off. Mm-hmm. And the responses are interesting. First of all, nitrate's not like vinyl chloride. Vinyl chloride will kill you if it's in high enough concentration. An adult. Nitrate will make adults sick, perhaps, and it will kill babies, but vinyl chloride is much nastier. But our responses range from, oh my God, I've got to get a treatment system on this right away, to been drinking it for 40 years, ain't killed me yet. So, and then everything in between. But what we found to be the most effective is the educational component. It's like anytime you want to get change, education outreach is the first thing you do. You can't do any new rules, regulations, policies until the people understand what it's really about. And an interesting statistic I'll bring up, you know more about it than I do perhaps, but in the late 90s there was a survey done in Dakota County, Washington County, and then two counties in southwestern Minnesota. And the survey was, how well do you know your drinking water and the nitrate and all that stuff that's in it? Well, Rock County and Pipestone County came out, everybody knew about it. Washington and Dakota, people didn't know about it. So right then and there, we made that our number one effort. We need to teach our citizens what the heck they're drinking and where it comes from. And we felt so strong about the commitment that we hired a water educator, a full-time water educator, to help us not only with emerging issues, but where does my water come from and what does nitrate mean. So does that kind of help you a little bit?
Well, I suspect you get some people, on the pesticides in particular, which would persist for considerably longer, you know, aren't bacterial in nature.
Yeah.
I was at a hearing in the Senate, and someone just said, when did it become okay to have anything in the well? And
right.
Of course, we breathe all sorts of stuff every day in the air, too, so you have to come to some acceptance level. But do you have people bringing out their torches and pitchforks and going after the pesticides, or what do they do?
We find that, with the exception of those pesticides that exceed drinking water standards, that the individual consumer really must set his or her level of what they're willing to accept. Because what you might accept and what I might accept are going to be completely different, and it's a level of comfort and peace of mind. So I think that's important to recognize. And
We do hear a lot of frustration that we have these problems, and they're so well documented, and they are persisting. And even as we address them, if we took away all the contamination at the surface this year, it would take 10 to 20 to 50 years for it to go away from the drinking water supply. So we do hear frustration from our citizens that the contamination is there.
But I've just seen your slide here with nitrate and pesticides in private drinking water wells in Dakota County where you send it out to the residents. I can't mm-hmm. think that we have anything like that in our neck of the woods that I can see.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just trying to find out what we can translate to other parts, at least in the metro area, but you've gone a step beyond where you've kind of answered some lingering questions, and that takes you to another plane of questioning. Well, now what do we do? And
that's a
pickle I think we're going to be in, is mm-hmm. figuring out how to address that strategically. Thanks very much. Representative Osmond and then Representative Clark.
I'd just like to make a comment. If many of these things are kind of cyclical, they kind of keep coming back at us all the time. I remember when I was first elected to the legislature, I was actually showering in 7 chemicals plus water in my home, and we had a rural water system then established in central mm-hmm. Dakota County, city of Rosemount, because of the contamination that we had from chemical disposal at the University of Minnesota properties. When I was legislator for a lot of the rural area in Dakota County in the 80s, we had a lot of people that were very knowledgeable and aware that nitrates were high in their drinking water, and people were not letting their, especially children, mm-hmm. drink the water. But then as time goes on, the things change, people get older, then they start, well, it's not quite as dangerous, and then they start forgetting about it, and the nitrates haven't gone away. If anything, they get worse. And so it's a constant. It's not something we can come up with a fix that will actually it's done with, now we can go on.
Yeah.
It's actually something we have to keep doing, mm-hmm. and that's what Dakota County has been so terrific at, is really kind of continuing to get that information out there, because we have an increase in population as people mm-hmm. grow older. Families change. The little kids are now bigger, so it's not mm-hmm. quite as big a deal as in their minds anyway, as they originally, when they were little babies. Nobody let the little babies drink the water, and
mm-hmm.
yes. and then they start to forget. And then the next people come along, they don't know that they're not supposed to let their little children drink the water. So it's a constant educational process. But I sure hope you find that magic bullet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if that's good. We'll see. Representative Clark.
Thank you. That's such a good description of the whole constant vigilance mm-hmm. process. I do have a question about nitrates and impacts on elders. And I don't know if you can tell us the latest research on that, but I do know, one of the reasons nitrates are dangerous to little children, and now we know that some of the endocrine disruptors and pesticides and so on, they're dangerous at at least three stages of life, prenatally and very early on, because there's all this cell division going on. Early puberty, because there's all this cell division going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in elders, my understanding is, because our immune system is starting to decline, we also have a level of vulnerability. And I'm just thinking, if you are aware of, in terms of nitrates, that particular impact on elderly at all, the other contaminants would apply to what kind of research is being done on that. And partly I'm thinking of it as... because I really want to know. I'm going to be one of those people getting into those ages. Mm-hmm. I am already. But I think of the motivation, again, of people, as you were talking about, if people start understanding that health impacts don't just stop with little children and rapid cell division. It happens when cell division is really declined, then you don't have the immune response that you used to have. Can you tell me anything about that as a scientist, an environmental scientist?
I haven't seen anything that particularly focuses on impacts on the elderly. Most of what I've seen has been either on infants and children or on women, in terms of specialized populations.
Is anybody studying that?
I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Our next presenters come to us from the Metropolitan Council. Chris Elverum and Keith Buttleman. All right.
Yeah, that one right there.
This is definitely higher tech than we've got.
Chance for you to get lost somehow. I've lost it now. Here we go. Losing it too.
Like I'm at mission control.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Keith Bottleman. I'm Assistant General Manager for the Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council. And that's the portion of the council that's involved in the water supply study that was were charged with by the legislature a couple of years ago. I want to lead off this presentation with just sort of an overview of what it is we're doing. And then Chris Elbrum, who is the manager of our newly created water supply section, will take the rest of it. Also want to note that in the audience are two of our staff members, our only two staff members, Sarah Bertelson and Lanya Ross, who are participating in a lot of the technical work that's going on in the area of water supply planning. Oh, it does work. Just a little bit of background about why we're involved in this at the moment. The metro area, the 7-county metropolitan area, has about 2.8 million users of water supply systems. And you can see here the breakdown of the general breakdown of sources of water supply in the metro area. The key thing to point out, though, I think, is that right now there's over 1 billion gallons per day withdrawn for all sources, I mean all uses of water. And the municipal portion of that, the part that we're mainly concerned with, is looking to increase by about 50% by the year 2050. That in the context of a very fragmented structure with the nearly 200 separate political jurisdictions within the 7 counties, there are 109 separate water utilities, each responsible for finding its own source of water, developing the distribution system, and dealing with all aspects of water supply. And in many cases, these are very small systems, a single well, very small distribution network, and that sort of thing. Based on the difficulty that is fairly obvious to imagine of a system like that, a very fragmented system, moving on into the future where there's going to be about a 50% increase in demand on water supply, the legislature charged the Metropolitan Council and a number of state agencies with studying this issue and developing a master plan for water supply for the metropolitan area. This slide shows some of the basic aspects of that charge, the development of these of basic technical information and updates and figuring out how to clarify the roles of all of the different governmental entities that are now currently involved in water supply planning. Doing that with advice from a committee, which I'll get to in a second, and then reporting to the legislature first at the end of phase one at the beginning of last year's session, and then at the end of the 08, the calendar year 08, the development of the actual master plan for water supply for the metro area itself. The plan would provide guidance for the development of local water systems and figure out a way of dealing with issues that arise that may affect the availability of water, particularly where some sort of joint approach between one or more local governments or perhaps state-level assistance or at least some sub-regional type of effort might be appropriate and would actually add value to the process. In many cases, the current system is working very well. In other cases, there are some difficulties on the horizon, so trying to get a handle on those, how to deal with those difficulties before they become serious is one of the main objectives of this plan. The advisory committee that I mentioned includes four state agencies, you can see who they are there, as well as seven representatives of cities, one from each of the seven metropolitan counties. The development of the master plan itself is going to be based on evaluating the supplies and the demands and will attempt to improve the reliability, the efficiency, the security of the regional system overall. You're going to see this again. You don't need to commit it to memory or anything right now. There is a copy in the document that was provided to you before the report to the legislature, but this basically shows in a conceptual fashion the way we're envisioning this master plan. At the top you see the demand projections, and that's influenced by a variety of things, including population forecasts. That's a huge element in influencing what demand is going to be. Current level of water use, climate change, conservation, land use, all of that goes into estimating demand projections. And at the same time, evaluating the availability of the resource itself. And that's influenced by how well groundwater recharges, how much of the groundwater or surface water is contaminated and therefore not available for use. Surface water, how much of the metro area is served by surface water, the aquifers and their availability, and all of those factors. Those two things will come together in an analysis of water supply availability and limitations. And as I said, for a large number of communities, there won't be much of a problem. They're either already pretty much built out and don't need to increase their water supply dramatically, or they are served by aquifers that are well established to provide the amount of water that they're going to need. But there will be some areas that are not as well served by the geography or the geology of the area. And for those, the plan will focus on what options are available, what options are preferable, and will focus on ways of making those options available to those local governments then. That's in broad terms the concept of this planning effort that's ongoing. And like I said, we will be developing the master plan with the help of the advisory committee and participation by a wide range of other state agencies, local agencies, some federal agencies, and other interested parties throughout the metropolitan area over the next year and a half. And we'll be glad to report back to you at that time on the results of all of that. I'm going to turn the rest of this over to Chris Elwin to talk about some of the more technical aspects of what's going on and the report that was issued to the legislature at the beginning of last session. And we'll both be available for questions at the end. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Chris Elwin, the manager of water supply planning for the Metropolitan Council. And I'm going to talk a lot about groundwater today. We're not going to ignore surface water. Surface water is a big component of our water supply systems. But groundwater, as Keith showed in the first or the second slide, and as Dakota County pointed out, much of the region uses groundwater, and virtually all of the developing areas in the region use groundwater. And it's the part of the water cycle we know the least about. And there's good reason in the metro area that we use groundwater. We have several high-capacity aquifers, depending where you are. There might be two, three, or four groundwater aquifers available for use. Generally, it requires little or no treatment. Some communities simply pump the water out, add chlorine and fluoride, and distribute it into their system. Others will take out iron and manganese for aesthetic reasons. And of course, there are situations where there are problems with quality, but generally, those communities can get by with little or no treatment. It's less susceptible to the short-term climate changes. Because those are typically deeper aquifers, they recharge slowly, and rainfall or lack of rainfall does not affect them on a short term. The higher pumping that goes along with the dry period can cause problems. And most importantly, communities can add wells as they develop. It's cheaper than building an upfront surface water supply, because a surface water supply requires a treatment system, requires filtration, whereas a groundwater system, they can add wells as they develop. So it's a pay-as-you-go, and typically it's the low user fees pay for the cost of service and for the development of the system.
I'd like to ask you about that.
Sure.
Say, dirt cheap, you're talking about the cost of extraction, more or less, as opposed to building a large capital facility that would be on the river, for example, that does that dirt cheap price include the value of the resource? We don't really know what it is, right? I mean,
correct, Mr. Chair. The value of the resource and what it takes to manage that is something that's not factored in. But a well, maybe cheap is all relative, is could be $500,000 for a municipal well, which is cheap as compared to a surface water treatment plant, which could be easily $20 million. And so the well and the infrastructure, although it's not cheap, in my opinion, it's cheap for a city as compared to surface water supply.
Representative Borghinius has a question.
On this question, and it's only cheap if you are confident that we are withdrawing at a rate and we'll be able to withdraw at a rate that's totally sustainable. In other words, we'll have as much groundwater in 40 years as we have right now. Are you totally confident of that?
Mr. Elmer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wiggins, the fact that it's cheap, yes, does not take into consideration the management or the long-term sustainability. And the effort that we're undertaking here is intended to address that issue. And certainly, I would not say that all of our withdrawal or all of the projected demand in the region is completely sustainable. And that's something that maybe as I go through this, we can discuss in more detail. But it only takes into consideration that it's cheap because they can add wells, and in the past they've gotten plenty of water, but the cumulative impact is something that is what we're trying to address here.
But you're putting that out as, you know, almost telling us that in a way that is the right model. And so I'm concerned. We'll hold that question until later, but I am going to re-ask that question about your confidence in the sustainability of what's going on right now.
Okay.
Good. Right ahead.
Thanks.
I'm sorry, Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that point, I think it's more of from the, as I'm looking through here quickly, it looks like that's more of a criticism eventually than it's dirt cheap.
Yes, yes.
More what?
A criticism of our current process. And I think that's where it's going to go to. It's not like they're supporting the dirt cheap. It's that's a problem.
Well, and if you see from this slide, the result of that situation, that communities have been able to develop their own systems, has really resulted in a mentality that we're going to supply ourselves, we're going to drill our own wells. You know, unless there's a real problem that faces us, we can take care of ourselves. Communities do have interconnections very often with neighboring communities, but for the most part, those are at the edge of town where the mains are the smallest, and they can only be used for an emergency and supplement a supply. And quite often their water chemistries might be different, so they only use those for an emergency. And the important point, which I think might get a little bit towards your question, is that that because each community is developing their own system and drilling their own wells, there hasn't been a coordinated look at the resource availability. Each community is looking at where they're going to put their next well. They want to know that well is going to have pump enough water, maybe their next five wells, but they're not looking at what their neighbors are planning and what their neighbors are planning and what the impact is on the trout stream. And so that's really what has led to the charge by the legislature for us to do a more resource or coordinated approach in the region. We did divide it into two phases, and as Keith mentioned, the report to the legislature was due at the beginning of this year, and you have it in front of you. We really used that phase to do an inventory of what's going on in the region. We looked at water supply systems to understand better how many wells we have, how much storage, different kinds of treatment, those kind of things. We updated demand projections out to 2050 so we can look at least that far. We did a preliminary analysis of resource limitations, looking at things like what is the impact of withdrawal on surface water features. This is, again, a very preliminary assessment to focus our effort. We did some recharge mapping and some hydrogeologic mapping to better understand the source of water and how much we might be able to pump in the future, and have begun working more recently with Dakota County and the Health Department to map known contaminant areas in the region. In addition to those technical studies, we have begun to evaluate some more institutional aspects of water supply planning, including the decision and regulatory process, and I think the Dakota County alluded to that earlier. It's something I'm not going to talk in any detail today, but would be happy to answer questions. But we are looking at each of the individual roles from all the way from municipal suppliers on up to the state agencies and determining if there's better ways to coordinate that effort. We have also examined safety, security, and reliability in water supply in the region and have come up with some next steps that the health department is primarily undertaking. We have evaluated water conservation, what types of conservation efforts are in the region. We developed a conservation toolbox to improve or to provide resources to local communities and others for water conservation, and we'll continue to look for opportunities to improve conservation in the region. And we have also in the first phase began the discussion of how do we fund our ongoing planning for one thing, and then on a different scale capital improvements that might have a regional or state benefit, and I'll get to that specifically in a second here. This information was all included in the report to the legislature. This report summarized the activities in the first phase. It also laid out next steps for the second phase, which we are currently about halfway through. And it also had two specific recommendations to the legislature. The first recommendation basically did a couple of things. One, to clarify the water supply plan requirements for communities. Before this recommendation, there was plan requirements in the DNR statute and in the Met Council statute. Those have been combined. It also required that those local water supply plans now be consistent with the master water supply plan when it's completed. And a third thing, it also required that the DNR approve our master water supply plan. The DNR being the permitting agency for water appropriations, we felt was critical to have their buy-in and participation at a very integral level in our water supply planning efforts. So requiring them to approve our plan is something that they had already been involved in, but this just adds a little more formality to it. The second recommendation dealt specifically, the second part of it, with the interconnection between the Minneapolis and St. Paul water supply systems. These are by far our two largest water supply systems in the region, and other than their own built-in redundancies, they don't have a backup that they could use in an emergency. And they have had interest for the past 60 years on one part or the other to connect those systems. More recently, though, both water supply utilities have an interest, and we did an evaluation of the benefit or the potential risk to the region if one of those water supply systems to go down, and it was clear that would be to have that backup available would be a benefit, and so we recommended that funding be supported for that effort. And the first part of the recommendation also set the stage for future capital improvements that if it was determined there was a regional or state benefit for some particular project, then we recommended that that be considered for state support. And as part of the second phase, we are going to evaluate how we determine what kind of things would have a state or regional benefit and how we actually fund those things on the long term, if it's an ongoing source or through bonding or whatever that might be. One of the important aspects of that first phase was also this projected supply adequacy, and as I mentioned, this was a preliminary assessment, but basically, we consider things like future demands, availability of aquifers locally, and the impact of those withdrawals, and came up with areas that we would focus on in the second phase, and those are shown in orange on this map. The Minneapolis-St. Paul systems are special in that they use surface water supply, and they have their own concerns, and we aren't ignoring those too, but I'll get to those basically at the end of the presentation. So we use this as kind of the screening to focus our efforts on the second phase. And really in the second phase, our main question is how do we sustainably manage our water supplies? And in order to answer that overarching question, we ask some more specific questions, such as how much will we need, are the aquifers available where we want them or where we're growing, are we taking more out than is getting back into the aquifer? That's not a very simple question. What is the impact of withdrawals? What on neighboring wells or on surface water features? How will drought and climate change affect supplies in the future or demands in the future? And what about contamination? We heard a lot about that from Dakota County, and fortunately many of the other agencies are that's their purview to evaluate contamination, but when planning for long-term supplies is something that we need to take in consideration. And I'll talk a little bit more about each of these in subsequent slides. The resource availability assessment, you saw this already, and I don't think you need to memorize it now either, but there's a lot that goes into this, and this really shows the approach we're taking, and there'll probably be a significant part of the region where we won't have to spend a lot of effort, and maybe simply ongoing monitoring will be the recommendation for those parts of the region. But there'll be areas where we'll have to consider options, and they will necessarily require communities to think a little more regionally. They will have to not give up a little bit of that local control, and that's that mentality I mentioned before. But one of the main tools that we're using to evaluate water resource sustainability is a metro area groundwater model, and this is built upon the metro model that the PCA did in the late 90s through LCMR support, and it really has given us the framework to update this model, make it more robust, to use more the updated information that we have gathered since that was completed. But it also has its limitations. Reality for groundwater and natural systems is complex. It's a complex natural system. We have to break that down into manageable pieces, into numbers, really. And what we get out are numbers that are a simplification of nature. It's useful, but there'll still be some uncertainty with any model results. But we definitely can use that those results to better understand our issues. We can also use this updated model to reduce uncertainty. The results that we get will help us to focus our data collection efforts to reduce that uncertainty, and ultimately, and also to demonstrate areas where additional monitoring is necessary. One of the neat tools or aspects of this updated model is the part that's on top, as I'd say, the method that we're using to get water into the subsurface for recharge. And what it does is it's a very new tool that's been developed in Wisconsin between the USGS and their geological survey. But it takes into account things like precipitations, soils, topography, land cover. And then it puts it into this model and uses different factors and ultimately spits out recharge, the water that basically gets below the root zone. And what's really neat about this is that we'll be able to vary things like precipitation. We can simulate a long-term drought. We can also change land use and see how that might affect the amount of water that gets into the subsurface. Again, this also still has some limitations because it's a simplification. We're using a 30-meter by 30-meter grid cell because that's our digital elevation model. That's the refinement. So little bitty, parking lots and things will have to be averaged over that area. So there are some limitations, but it's an advancement to understanding recharge.
Check it in real quick. I think this is similar to a water balance study that's being proposed through LCCMR. The whole mass balance issue, too. Okay.
That was funded.
Okay.
One of the questions that we need to answer is how much are we going to need? And as was mentioned earlier, we're focusing a lot of our effort on the municipal use. It's by far the most significant consumptive use. Power generation, you can see, is really by far the highest use. But it's virtually all through four, once through cooling, it takes water out of the major rivers and puts it back right into the major rivers. They consume, at least the power plants in the metro area consume zero. They can take out a little bit, but they for the most part, consume 0%.
Sorry, Representative Bugini.
Yes, I want to look at one of your fundamental assumptions here, and that's the choice of the year 2050. I look at that, just help me out here. I look at that and see that you're not even planning for the lifetime of a child born today.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the 2050, I agree. That we use 2050 simply because we actually have population forecasts for 2050. But once we have this tool put in place, we can saturate the metro area with medium density residential growth and just not consider those situation. So the fact that we have 2050 up there is based on I can actually come up with a defendable number for population and demand. But I agree, we are not going to limit ourselves to 2050. When we have this tool, just to see what happens, we will saturate the metro area with growth and what the required pumping would be based on per capita use. But this is defendable and based on actual numbers. That's why it's 2050 is used.
Representative Regina.
I don't think it's defendable in terms of long-term planning. It may be defendable in your writing a model right this minute. But as I said, you are not planning for the lifetime of a child born today.
Mr. Chair and committee members,
I was kind of looking at 2050 is because we'll all be dead. You know, you don't have to worry about us nagging. It's not my problem. Yeah.
Yes, I like I said, I agree, and we will. The tools we'll have available will be able to address it beyond that. And I appreciate your comment, and we will consider that. Okay. The other category, just for your information too, is things like major crop irrigation, pollution containment, industrial use that's not part of a municipal system, and those are a little harder to predict. But if we saturate the metro with municipal supplies, we can assume that goes to virtually zero. Other things we will be considering in this evaluation include the impact of withdrawals on other users, and those can include private wells or shallower wells. We'll also be looking at the impact on natural resources, such as in this case it's a fen. This is kind of a schematic of the Savage area, not too far from here, where groundwater withdrawals did have an impact on a calcareous fen, which is a special protected wetland in the state. And as a result, the city of Savage had to go through extra effort to find other resources, other sources to supply the growing demand. This could also be a trout stream, as we're seeing now in Woodbury, or any other surface water feature. That connection that Dakota County pointed out between surface water and groundwater is something that we see is also very important.
Well, that's good.
The extent of aquifers is important in our consideration for long-term supplies. As you move to the north and the west, you have fewer and further bedrock aquifers. This shows the three major aquifers in the region. So where we are in Dakota County, we have the Prairie du Chien Jordan, which is the first most bedrock aquifer. Underneath that is the Franconia, Ironton, Galesville aquifer, and then below that, the Mount Simon Hinckley aquifer. But these rise toward the surface and disappear or pinch out as you move to the north and west, and by the time you get to St. Cloud, they don't have any of those bedrock aquifers, and in fact, the city of St. Cloud uses surface water as their source of supply. There, on top of all these bedrock aquifers is the glacial material, the sand, gravel, and clay that in some areas is used as a water source, in other areas has very low capacity. So that's a less reliable source, but in some areas can be used. Climate change, any discussion of resources needs to consider this. We have predictions as to what the climate might be like in the upper Midwest in 100 years. We will translate this into water supply scenarios, which would include allowing the growing season for more pumping, the rainfall, the precipitation is kind of hard, a challenge to incorporate into this model because some ways we'll get more rain, might be more spotty and more runoff. We might change our stormwater management to more low impact type management such as rain gardens and things that infiltrate more. So that'll be a challenge, but we'll be able to play with those factors and see how it affects long-term water supply. Contamination, we've heard a lot about that. There are naturally occurring contaminants such as radium, arsenic that water suppliers need to deal with already. And there are also man-made contaminants, as we heard a lot about today. This is actually a picture of the New Brighton water treatment plant, and they pump water from the ground that had been contaminated by the TCAP site, and it has chlorinated solvents. They treat it through this carbon filtration and distribute it to the system, and the residents drink it. Contamination can be a problem for suppliers, but if you have enough money or if you don't have any other sources, you can treat to drinking water standards. The other question that has already come up today is, well, how do we know what's in there? I mean, there are plumes that we know exist, and we can predict where we'll find those. But as we found in southern Washington County, things pop up that we aren't expecting. So that's again a question you've already dealt with a little bit, and we will continue to in the future. As I mentioned, some of these things that I've mentioned also deal with surface water, but the two main concerns when it comes to using surface water as a supplier are droughts or short-term climate change, I should say, and contamination. Because that water is at the surface, it's more susceptible to spills. It's also more susceptible to climate change. And we see that as an important part of the planning for the region because a third of our residents currently use surface water, and as we move to the north and west, surface water may become a more considered source. It might be used more and more as we run out of those aquifers or as these issues I've discussed become more prevalent. There are challenges for developing this regional water supply plan. We have a perception that we are water rich, and as compared to the desert southwest or to Georgia, as we're hearing a lot about now in the news, we do have relatively abundant supplies. We have these bedrock aquifers that the nation doesn't have. We also have three major rivers that run through the region, but those could be affected by a drought like they're seeing in the southwest. But a lot of the issues that we're dealing with here aren't necessarily, you know, do we have enough water right now? But is that water, is that pumping that we are proposing or that we're currently undertaking sustainable in that? Does it impact a surface water feature? Or, you know, we have plans to go along the I-94 corridor. Well, maybe those supplies become fewer and fewer, and we have to think about piping water from the Minneapolis system or from using more surface water. But this mentality that communities want to supply their own selves is something that we would have to overcome. They like to maintain control. So even though we may have enough water as a state or a region, it may not be where we are currently developing. And then, of course, the uncertainty that I mentioned earlier is always going to be there. When we simplify a natural system, and it makes it challenging for regulatory agencies to make decisions, it also allows competing interests to beat each other up with the facts. Each two groundwater scientists could look at this data and come up with, I wouldn't say completely different answers, but different interpretations based on that uncertainty. We're working very hard with our advisory committee, and we'll be developing our master plan throughout the next year. And I would like to say that this won't be a plan that will be, okay, we got the plan done, now we're okay. This is I would see that there will be a lot of ongoing effort. We will, some areas the effort might be very minimal, but in other areas we're going to have to do additional studies, and we'd be happy to come back and report on our efforts next year too.
Great, thank you. Representative Borgenius.
The thing I was listening for was your definition of sustainability. Do you have one beyond looking at 2050?
Mr. Chair and committee members, we don't currently have the working definition. The DNR has come up with a definition of sustainability that is kind of the state's definition that we use. One of the things that we're going to do early next year with our advisory committee is work on planning principles for the region. And that will be one of the questions that we will discuss with them. But we don't have a currently working principle. And I think sustainability in one area might be, is it impact the Star Stream, and another area is it simply is enough water getting into the groundwater. So it kind of depends on where you are, but it's something we need to flesh out.
It may also be that we plan for future generations.
Representative Osmond.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the work that's going into this. I do have a couple of comments and a question or two. You have focused quite a bit on groundwater and how this plan is going to be looking at groundwater sources and resources and sustainability of it and so forth. And that is something that has not been done well by the DNR. That's the reason why I was very encouraged to get Metropolitan Council kind of heading this whole thing up. But I'm concerned that the there's just a small amount of attention being given to the surface water, and yet long term, when we're talking about where water is going to come from, and we see our Brainerd Lake area, as I understand it, I think 20 years ago I was told that those were the reservoirs to keep the water into the Mississippi River, to keep St. Cloud and Minneapolis and part of St. Paul with water, and navigation, transportation on the river and so forth was dependent upon those. And yet they're some of our highest priced properties that are being developed in the state of Minnesota, and those people are going to go ballistic when we start draining their lakes, and their docks get to be as long as their roads in order to be able to try and reach the water. And how much of this plan are you able to deal with that type of an issue now, or is that kind of looked at as maybe some of those future reports that you alluded may be needed?
Mr. Elbrun.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mousman, actually one of the next steps that was defined in the report to the legislature was to update the state drought response plan and to clarify the issues surrounding release from the headwaters reservoirs. And I didn't mention it here in the interest of time, but we have been working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Minneapolis and St. Paul initially to discuss what are the criteria, what are the actions that need to be taken to request the release from the reservoirs. Ultimately, the Army Corps controls those reservoirs, and it's really up to them to release more water. And it ties directly to the state drought response plan that attempted to do that in the past, but wasn't clear as to how to go about that. So, and the Army Corps, in fact, has gone through a tabletop exercise internally. We had two droughts the last two summers. We forget when it starts raining again, but there was pretty significant dry periods in the state. And it's a timely issue, so we aren't ignoring that. We're also working with the U.S. Geological Survey on a project to better understand flows in the Mississippi River under various conditions. What they're going to do is a worst case winter plus a worst case summer for us, and statistically estimate the flows in the Mississippi River, and then what about several years of those in a row? So we are considering those aspects of it. I just wasn't able to include it all.
I did notice in my highlighted version that I looked at several weeks ago on page 16 and 17, there's a pretty thorough discussion, and Representative Osmond hit it right on the head about people upstream and how they're going to react. And I think you allude to how there is confusion, and the issue of collaboration and coordination and so on is going to be a recurring theme, I think, in the next couple of months as we talk about it. But okay, you had a follow up.
I do, Mr. Chair. Another report I know Metropolitan Council has been working on, I believe, is ready for distribution, or it will be shortly, is looking at the reuse of water.
and that one of the concerns that we're finding with reusing our wastewater is that it's heavy with chlorides, and that makes it difficult for manufacturers to be able to use it, or industry to be able to use it without doing something to it. And yet we look for the source of the chlorides, and they're really kind of in the residential homes called water softeners. And yet, as we're talking about water being dirt cheap, we are in fact, that's the way people are perceiving it yet. I remember when people thought that they wished gasoline was as available as water. And now it's kind of the other way around. It's going to wish we had more water. But the, when are we, will your report be addressing the, how much water should be costing people? And that we know that when we're in a society that really is a marketplace society, that when we're putting out a product that has significant future impact, its uses has future impact, but we're not getting people to pay for that now, going to wait for it to become scarce before we drive the costs up, that they're just going to continue to do the same old thing. They're going to continue to use water like they think it's water, instead of a really precious commodity that's becoming more and more limited. And will your report be addressing the cost that water really should be to the users, and that everybody's afraid to talk about and get into?
Mr. Elton. Mr. Chair and Representative Osment, the short answer is not in any great detail. We're scared to talk about it too, because basically, the water supply rates are set by each individual community, and having the Met Council involved in a regional planning effort scares some local communities. And we recognize the need for local control in a lot of ways. We don't want to run each water supply system, and the coordinated approach to resource management is important. Cost is interesting. Las Vegas' cost per thousand is cheaper than Minneapolis's. So water cost around the nation is relatively low, and even in areas that are what we consider very scarce. So it's something that should be addressed, and maybe we should add that to the list, but it's so far as making policy to uniform rates and things, it's a big challenge with the fragmented approach to water supply in the region.
Thanks for honestly saying that you're concerned about it. Sometimes people won't say what they really think. I had Representative Clark, Tinkelstedt, Wagenius, and Scalzi.
I know she used an interesting phrase, contaminant mapping. I couldn't find anything in here about any graphics or maps. Are those available?
They are not. We are working on it. This is something that has not progressed as fast as we could, because the basic reason is that there's a lot of different sources for contaminant reports, and they're all over in different agencies, and it's taking a lot of effort to gather that up. So it's an ongoing effort. We don't have a map yet, and I would expect that to be, even at the end of the master plan, to still need some work. So we can specifically, if you're looking for an area, help you with that, but that map that you're talking about is a goal, but it's going to take some time.
Representative, do you have a follow-up?
Just one of the things I'd like to say is the one thing about contaminants that we haven't talked very much about is prevention, preventing contamination. And there was a little bit in the previous discussion, but I think if we have those maps, that might be really helpful in understanding how to push that. So, and I don't know if that would be more local than the Metro Council, probably, but at least if you're helping us understand where that's coming from, it seems to be helpful.
Mr. Chair, there are, as Dakota County showed, there's excellent maps of the sites, and if you go to the PCA's website, there's a What's in My Neighborhood feature. You can see where the locations are, but we're working on improving that so that we can understand where the contamination actually is and plugging away at it.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be very brief. I just want to say they don't have all the sites at that What's in My Neighborhood map.
Representative Tinkelstedt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elverum, thank you for your presentation. I understand, you know, you're with the Met Council, so you have a limited number of counties that you're dealing with here in the metro area. And our next presenter will be John Wells, who will talk about some of those statewide things. You know, in your presentation, a couple times you mentioned the I-94 corridor to St. Cloud and that being a high-growth area for population and future use. I'm wondering just, like, what kind of outreach you have to some of those counties, how much you work with statewide people on coordinating things, talking to some of those counties beyond your Met Council area.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tingelstad, especially in the I-94 corridor, we have, because our growth is really to the border there, that we have worked with some of those communities, Elk River and Otsego and St. Michael, Albertville. We also have extended our groundwater model to the edge of the Mount Simon-Hinckley aquifer, which is about halfway to St. Cloud, halfway through Sherburne and Wright counties, because that's also the recharge area for our lower aquifers in this region, and it doesn't make any sense to stop our hydrogeologic study at a political boundary. We certainly can't develop a plan for those communities as part of a comp plan outside the metro area, but we're going to take into consideration their proposed withdrawals and what the impact will be across that political boundary, which is not a natural boundary. And so I think we can improve upon our coordination with those outside communities. We are working with all the state agencies, so that's not a problem. But when it comes to implementation of this plan, we will be left with that boundary as, you know, there might be some unfairness there's in the eyes of those communities within the metro area as compared to their neighbors who don't have the same limitation or the same situation because they don't have to do a comp plan for us, essentially. But we do want to coordinate with them.
Thank you.
Great. Representative Ruginius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Osmond asked two very important questions, and I want to follow up on each one of them. He first talked about your need to look at folks who take water from the river and will that river water be there. That is critical because if Minneapolis did not have river water, Minneapolis would have to use the aquifers. Mm-hmm. And if Minneapolis used the aquifers, there wouldn't be enough water in the aquifers. We know that. I mean, that's a given. So I think putting the river studies in and knowing that we will indeed have supplies, I mean, you can't give us a report that's adequate without that. So I think that's just dead right on. The second thing is when you talked, when he talked about the cost and our pricing, that's extremely important for us because it's not just the cost of the water, it's the value of the water. Right now, we are valuing watering the grass in the back 40 as important as drinking water for kids who are born today and will want to drink water when they're 60. And I think we've got to rethink how we, I know you're scared, and I understand that
you're very confident, though.
Shaking his eyes.
That you get pressure from people who are saying local control, but that the thing you've got to say back to them is they want to plan for their children as well as we do, and that we need to maybe reframe how we're talking about this, that we can't just frame it as enough water for 2050, because if that is the way we frame the issue, then the outcome will be steady, Eddie, as steady as you go. We have got to look at what is sustainable in this region for children born today and their children.
Mr. Chair, I would say that I appreciate that point, and we can bring that back to our advisory committee as the more political body, and they represent those local communities. So we're having a workshop with them in February to kind of talk about policy, and I will bring that comment to them and bring up the idea of cost, too, and how we can address it.
And value.
And value, yes, of course.
And Representative Scalzi.
And then Representative Osmond.
Can you tell me something about the once through HVAC systems? We have a number of them in the metropolitan area, and I know of quite a few in my area. And I'm wondering if you've analyzed these systems in the drawdown, and also if you will include them in your report as to their effect on these aquifers and their future effect, because some of these have been exempted from the 2010 sunset year, and some have special legislation to allow them to continue at a large rate. And I was wondering if your report, or if you've analyzed that, and if your report will address those issues.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grilton.
Yes, we will include in our assessment of supplies every permitted withdrawal. And so all those, if they're over 1 million gallons a year or 10,000 gallons a day, they will be included. And we will make a prediction as to whether or not they'll continue into the future, and we can determine which are exempted and which will sunset by 2010. So not only those once through cooling, but all the irrigation wells and all the industries that are significant withdrawers will be included. It will be a little more difficult to predict the additional industries or agricultural withdrawals, but we will use those as a cumulative impact on the withdrawal in the aquifer.
And as a follow-up, then, will you include recommendations to the legislature regarding those?
Mr. Chair, it's possible, yes. It depends on, from our advisory committee, guidance from them, from stakeholders, and what the actual impact is and what kind of policies we come up with. That's a possibility.
And Representative Osmond.
One last comment, Mr. Chair, because I'm going to have to go in a little bit. But the subcommittee may want to consider putting some of these things together in letter form and sending them to the Metropolitan Council and to the Advisory Committee, because when the legislation was developed in order to get some of these reports going, these very topics were the topics that were on the table at the legislature, especially the conflicts between the rural Minnesota recreational lakes and Minneapolis's drinking water, and the impact that the metropolitan area is having on the aquifers and the value of that water versus what the people are actually paying for it. And there's also with the report that's coming with regard to water reuse, when we get to a chance to see that, I think that it'll also jump out that there are things that we're doing on a regular basis within our homes that are causing difficulty in reusing that water. And maybe we need to be looking at some policies and changes in order to get that. It's easy to jump on industry and say, clean up your act, but maybe we should clean up our act within our own homes a little bit, too, so that we can actually put more value to that water for reuse. Instead of pushing it all on to whoever wants to reuse it, that they got to clean it up first before they can use it. We're competing with groundwater. Groundwater is pristine. If we want to have our wastewater be competitive with that on an economic basis, maybe those of us that are dirtying that water up need to help clean it up.
Can I follow up on that?
Certainly, okay. Representative Wiggins.
I think that's an excellent idea. One of the ways we can talk about that is, and our pricing and our value, is that Minneapolis pays a ton of money to clean up the Mississippi River. So the price of our water is high, but the folks who use clean water pay very little. Is that right?
For the most part, it depends on the community and their philosophy.
I know that is right in terms of fact. I'm talking about, is that right in terms of right and wrong?
Oh.
Is that appropriate? That dirty water is more expensive than clean water, and I think that's getting partially to the point that he is talking about.
I'm not sure you're looking for an answer there. You're just
no, I'm not.
Okay. This could be a good chance to tell you I put in a dual flush water conserving toilet at my house.
Very good.
Two buttons and everything. It's great. I'll bring pictures next time. Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you started your presentation, you mentioned about 1 billion gallons a day and how that's going to increase in the future. And yesterday we had some discussion in the Environment Committee about water recharge and statewide, and I'm trying to understand this technical document here from the USGS. But perhaps you know, so based on your estimate there, so in 1 year the metro area would use over 300 billion gallons of water. And so how many inches of rain do we need? And especially in light of your climate change slide, how many inches of rain do we need to kind of recharge some of that?
Is that a mind-blowing question?
No. Mr. Chair and Mr. Over, Representative Kikoset, I did a calculation based on groundwater withdrawal. So that wouldn't include surface water withdrawal, and it wouldn't include that the power generation. But I estimated 2.5 inches is if you flood the metro area with 2.5 inches, that's approximately the volume that we're pumping out of the ground. And of course, that recharge can come from outside the metro area, and it's the pumping is localized in areas and not in others. So there's a lot of things that go into it. But 2.5 inches is
per year.
Yes.
That's not a rain. Excuse me.
Representative McGinnis.
Thank you. Is that of rain or of water that actually gets in, and how much rain do you have to get 2.5 inches back in?
Right. I was going to suggest, and we'd like to wrap this one up by 11, that we actually are hoping to bring in some hydrogeologists or hydrologists and so on who have some studies on those, and that's right. Actually what's really freaking me out, because my water in Shoreview comes from a confined aquifers, and the amount that actually gets down there is very small. So I wonder if we could defer on that, if that's all right. Can I ask one parting question, or two actually? How are cities taking it, that they now have to include water supply planning in their comp plans? Is that filtering down to them?
They have had to include water supply plans since 1995. This was the result of the drought of '88.
Okay.
But they are actually, we have a lot of support for our regional planning effort. They recognize that they need to think beyond their borders too. So I think 15 years ago we would have got beat up pretty bad, but now we have a lot of cooperation and support from the local suppliers.
Okay. The only other thing I had was, it was a question that constituents and local reporters in my area are asking. What went wrong with Atlanta that will not hopefully happen here? What is the difference?
Well, Mr. Chair, my understanding is Atlanta, for one thing, is at the top of a watershed, and they rely mostly on surface water. They don't have the groundwater sources that we have. For those that use surface water, a prolonged drought could have a potential impact, but fortunately for communities that use groundwater, the short-term drought wouldn't necessarily have the same impact. They don't have the groundwater, and their rivers are pretty small volume because they're at the top of the mountain there, I guess.
Pretty good. Thanks very much. Representative Clark, did you have a final question?
Just an observation, I guess. I think I've heard a number of times the statement that, the water in the aquifers is pure, and I think what we heard before is we don't really know. And I actually say I grew up on a farm, southwestern Minnesota, where when all the other wells went dry, ours didn't. And I knew as a little kid that we had an aquifer. I learned that word under us. A big lake was explained to me. And now they can't use that water down there. And my dad, for example, has to be on rural water imported from further up Minnesota. So I'm just cautious about, kind of continually hearing Dr. Waters and how pure. We don't know that. And in some places, we know it's not now. So I just want to put that caution out there. Comment.
Great. Thank you. I know you'll be monitoring the committee, and we may follow up on Representative Osmond's suggestion to send you some comments. And
we would appreciate that.
Great.
Thank you.
I've discovered that legislators do not have superpowers except for one thing, and that is to be able to sit in place for 3 or 4 hours or more at a time. So we're going to keep going through to noon here because we do need to get some folks out to somewhere else. But our third set of presenters are from the Minnesota Environmental Quality Board. They've been very patient to sit for that amount of time. John Wells and Princesa Van Buren. from up in Shoreview, I think.
She is, not me. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're delighted to be here and to give you an overview of some work that we've been doing. You have, I think, in front of you, and the audience doesn't, but audience members, it isn't available online, or if you call me, if you can't print out our report on looking at supply and demand across the state, strictly a quantity analysis. We also have at the back of your report the latest Environmental Quality Board's priorities report, which talked about three areas of priorities: wetlands, clean water legacy, and water supply issues that might be of interest to you. Well, as you know, water affects everything, and its value to the state and to the people of the state, it defines Minnesota. And, you know, we use it for agriculture, economic development, it affects land use. All those things on the screen there are intertwined, and I think you've heard that message before. It's an important one for us to always keep in mind. So I will discuss a little bit about the report, Use of Minnesota's Renewable Water Resources Moving Towards Sustainability, which highlights what we know and what we don't know about water resources. We think that the report informs planning and it raises important questions about the path we're on right now. Let me give you a little tiny background about the Environmental Quality Board. The board is pretty unique in the country. It's made up of 9 state commissioners, and only those commissioners can serve on the board. They can't send alternates. That's sometimes a blessing and sometimes a curse. But it also has 5 citizen members who are appointed by the governor to staggered 4-year terms, and a representative of the governor's office who by law is to chair the board. Right now, we have the chair is the Commissioner of Agriculture. It's not an unprecedented thing to have one of the agency members chair the board, although and it has worked fairly well in the past, although we would ideally like to have somebody like a Bob Schroeder who used to chair the board. The dilemma with that is sometimes those people don't have the time, so it's kind of a complication there. But that's who we are. Our mission is we are to develop strategic plans for Minnesota's environment and development, including the state water plan and those biennial water priorities reports and biennial water assessments that we make with our partners. And we also oversee the environmental review process. The governor's clean water cabinet is now considered a committee of the Environmental Quality Board. And the cabinet identified this vision on behalf of the governor: keep our waters clean, ensure communities have plentiful, safe water, maintain an accurate picture of our water resources. And this was their language: restore the casualties of society's great progress. And that's something that you've been talking about a lot today. Okay, I'm not anticipating that this would come up so frequently in the previous talks, but we decided to take a crack at defining sustainability. And we've done this over the years. We, as you might know, the Environmental Quality Board managed the governor's Sustainable Development Initiative in the 90s. And one of the things that we always ran into was people were kind of foggy about what sustainable development meant, or sustainability, just to remove that development confusion out of the equation. And my staff and I decided we needed to just boil this down to the essence. So what you're going to get here is our version of the essence of what sustainability is. And number one is thinking and acting as if the long-term future mattered. And we put that kind of cavalierly like that because we often don't think about it. And that's something that we have to do more of. We need to do more than just understanding today's needs and wants to be sustainable. And although they can't be at the table, a community's future residents have every bit as much, if not more, at stake in that community's future as current residents. And it's just kind of a mindset that we have to get ourselves into thinking that way. Recognizing how things connect. Now, you've already heard that from Dakota County folks. And the council, surface water and groundwater are one. They are interconnected intimately. They go back and forth between the two. One supplies the other and vice versa. Water quality and quantity are interrelated, and they affect the fate of quality can affect the availability or quantity available to people, and vice versa. Land and water are connected intimately. So what we do on the land ends up in the water. And finally, just more generally, more globally, water and people and economies and ecosystems are all connected. So when we talk about wanting to worry about emerging contaminants and deal with those. I was at a Minnesota Environmental Initiative workshop about 10 days ago on that very subject, focusing on things like PFCs and so forth, and the 80,000 plus chemicals already in our artificial chemicals already in our environment. There's 2,000 to 3,000 more they suggested added each year. Well, guess what? We have 149 standards that EPA has identified nationally, 149 out of 87,000. So it's kind of like, okay, how are we going to, when are we going to wake up and understand that connection, that it's, we're a chemical society. So we have to be very careful about those chemicals. And if you've heard Paul Hawken in the past talk at some conferences we had here on sustainable development, if you could call up Dow Chemical and say, hey, there's some mistake, I found one of your chemicals in my well, would you come get it, please? And if we can't do that, if you could tag those, and there are actually ways of doing that now, but if we aren't willing to accept that, then we'd better not be putting chemicals in a position where they will get into the environment, because they will find a way to do that.
I know.
Living within our means, well, that means a lot of things. It means understanding limits today and in the future. It means understanding, for water context, what are sustainable yields. And I use the word sustainable in that context to mean, okay, not only how much can we pump out of the ground, but how much can we pump out of the ground over the long term without drawing down the resource and without drawing down surface water resources. So it's a complicated issue. And understanding the demands of ecosystems, like what do we need in streams or in wetlands to support those ecosystems, as well as the needs of people and the economies. Living within our means also means respecting limits, not just understanding, but respecting those limits. And it means managing aquifers and watersheds, not just wells, in the one case, for aquifers. It means accepting limits to growth and changing the face of economic activity, which is what I was talking about earlier, so that we are very cognizant of what chemicals we create, because they're going to get up, they will get into the environment. So dealing with that is easier said than done, but that's an important thing for us to think about. And the last thing, this is probably not a principle, but taking creative approaches to issues, what I think about that is, number one, making the marketplace work so that the conversation you were having about putting a price on water, actually in one of our previous water EQB Water Priorities Report, and I think, I don't remember what year it was either 2 or 4 years ago when I presented to Representative Osmond's committee, we did talk about we don't place a value on water. It's not just placing value or recouping the cost of providing that water, whether it's drilling a well or building a water supply treatment plant. It's placing a value on the resource itself. Well, we don't do that. And actually, culturally in this country, it's hard to be, in this state as well. We think of water as a free good that everybody has a right to. It's the riparian doctrine. We have a right to a use of water that is in the land adjacent to, under the land or going by the land that we own. But we have the opportunity to consider placing a value on water. And that would, you know, an economist will tell you, if you don't do that, you'll waste the resource. That's the whole point of placing a dollar value on water, which it seems like you're well aware of. So taking creative approaches to issues also means taking responsibility for making those connections between water quality and quantity, surface and groundwater, and land use and so forth, and our whole approach to society. Finding new partners and communicating with them in their language simply and often, and some of the reasons we didn't get as much done in our sustainable development initiative in the 90s as we should have was because we didn't do that very well. And we need to find ways of doing that more effectively. Okay, enough on my sustainability thing. Well, actually, no, I'm going to give you some principles of sound water management. These were in our 2005 to 2007 Water Priorities Report from the Environmental Quality Board. Well, what we would like is a water program that is transparent and easily understood, so that even though there are maybe close to a dozen agencies with roles in water management, that they all work as if they were one agency. Think about that and how we can make that happen. And that the transparent and easily understood means people know what we're doing and why. We integrate and coordinate among those agencies, state and federal and local as well. And we just work together effectively, seamlessly. That's the ideal. We make the link to land use. If I were focusing this talk only on groundwater, I would say make the link to surface water as well as the quality-quantity connection. We collect and interpret data needed by decision makers so that they have the information to make sensible decisions. We involve local governments and citizens, kind of a commonly accepted thing now. It's not easily done sometimes when you're sitting in the state domain. And we address problems, I would say, I would add to that, in a sustainable manner and prevent new ones. And we act in that unified economical manner. So the set of principles that the Environmental Quality Board put in one of its earlier priorities reports, FYI. The report we're going to be talking about this morning is, we called it a water sustainability project. And I have to say, we use sustainability in this context to be quantity. It's a terrible narrowing of what the real term means, but bear with us on that. The law that we're operating under is in 103A, 43, item C. EPD shall work with the DNR to coordinate an assessment and analysis of the quantity of surface and groundwaters in the state and the availability of water to meet the state's needs. That's supposed to be done every 2 years. The reports are due September 15th and so forth. We are working on an update to the one that we're presenting to you today, or will be working on it. It's due next September 15th. Our partners, Principal One DNR. EPRI is the Electric Power Research Institute. On this particular project, we used some of their information and a journal refereed article on supply and demand at the county level across the country. And so their information provided one of our supply estimation techniques. The Health Department, Met Council, Minnesota Geological Survey, the University of Minnesota is working on and has developed, initially through the Minnesota Geological Survey, a supply estimation methodology that actually looks at what's coming out of the system. Not what's going into the system, but what's coming out of the system, which is actually a more complicated and sometimes, I would argue a more profound way of viewing the resource when you're looking at long-term limits. And that's one that we used in our methods, as well as USGS as a partner, and we'll get into details about how they helped us out on the supply side in particular in a minute. Okay, so sustainable supply and use. The top definition is our kind of qualitative definition, the quantity of water that could be removed from the system on a renewable basis without drawing down the resource. So that, Representative Borghenius, as you were suggesting, so that 50 years from now or 150 years from now, we can be assured that we'll still have that resource there. And so what's renewable and how much can you pull from that renewable resource while maintaining ecosystems and meeting people's needs is the key. DNR has developed a definition of sustainable use, which is the one you see there. Sustainable water use is the use of water to provide for the needs of society now and in the future without unacceptable social, economic, or environmental consequences. And we mentioned that in our report. The thing I want to qualify on it is without unacceptable, if a community decides to accept soiling their own nest, that doesn't make it sustainable in my mind. So there's got to be some other limit embedded in that. I don't know if that's the question you were going to ask Representative or not. But.
With that caveat, without unacceptable, I mean, that's such a judgmental issue that the exception has eaten the rule in this case.
And I also share your concern with that. Okay, need for this particular project. I just wanted to call your attention to that photograph there, which Princesa took. It's of the St. Louis River during really low flows, like no flow. And that river should have a lot more water in it. It's just been because of the drought. And that's an area where it obviously doesn't have a great connection to the groundwater, which is why you don't see a whole lot of water there. But it does make us realize how fragile our water resources are. So understand how Minnesota is doing on supply and demand. With one possible exception, we just really haven't looked at how we're doing on supply and demand. We haven't been taking the pulse of are we on the right track, and if we're not, what are we going to do about it? Well, this is in some ways the first focused effort to do that. There was a study by DNR Ecological Services in the year 2000 which did that on a watershed basis, and it's worth looking at. They're obviously more focused on surface water ecosystems and the implications of that. But so in a sense, ours is a complement to that study. So we want to also define unknowns in quantity and use, recognize the importance of water resources in planning for development or growth. And all of this, the need, has been highlighted by the drought of the last couple of years, and that photo certainly highlights that. I'm going to turn it over to Princesa to talk about the technical details, and then I'll be back in a bit. Thanks.
Good morning. I'm Princesa Van Buren, and I'm very happy to be here. John's done a great job of explaining the background, the need, the statutes that we're addressing, and I get to talk to you about technical.
so I'm not going to try to be boring. Hopefully I can get through this quickly. The point in trying to be to tell you about the technical aspects of what we've done is so you can better understand the study, some of the limits of the study, what we can conclude from it, and some of the things that we need in the future so we can better answer some of these questions. So first off, what we did is we looked at things at the county scale. Granted, we could look at aquifer scale, watershed scale, or so on, but county is a good level for management, for understanding where we're at. The study was completed, it was published this past spring, but we did it in 2006, so the most recent data we had was through 05. So we used 05 as our baseline to see where we are now, and then we extrapolated it out to 2030. At the time that we went to 2030, there are two reasons for that. My council was looking to 2030, and the state demographer's office right now has only given us population information to that date. And so granted, yes, we need to look to the future, but that's where we were in looking at this study. And so what we did at this county scale is we looked at water supply, as I'll explain, defining it through a variety of methods, and then looked at use, the water demand, to see how they match up. So just a little tantalizing preview. What we found here is in 05, four counties used more than half of their sustainable supply, and the range statewide was from 1% to 135%. Then going out to 2030, how do things change as our population increases? Seven counties now are estimated at more than half of their resource, and the range has grown from 1 to 177%. So the steps that we did, how do we go about it? Well, first we started looking at determining what's the current water use. Then we estimated future use. And then we had to define the other side, supply, and compare the two to see where we're at. In terms of our current water use, there's two components to it. The majority of our work was using permitted water information. Instead of just using 2005, which would be affected by weather variations, climatic variations, we use the 11-year period, 95 to 2005. It's the most recent information we have, and it allows some of that variability to be neutralized. So we worked on summarizing the DNR permit database. We compiled population by county, and we did everything based on a per capita usage. What we find during this time, 95 to 05, is that statewide water use increased 18%. We saw only a 12% increase in population during the same 11 years. So what that reflects is a 6% per capita increase. We haven't yet plateaued. We're not stopping. We're still increasing a little bit more per person, according to the data. Now, the other aspect that we quantified is unpermitted. What I mean by that is water that doesn't require a DNR permit. Largely, we're talking about residential systems. So we have this big database of information, but what about the individual homeowner who's a private well? We needed to try to quantify that, too. And we did that using DNR, or Department of Health population data, municipal well data, and census data. And from that, we were able to estimate how much water was being consumed by people who didn't require a permit. Statewide, this is about 2% of the total. So what we did is we added the permitted to the unpermitted to give us this baseline per capita consumption. So 2005, we calculated this baseline using 11 years of data, so it's been neutralized to the impact of climatic variations. I call that gross water use because the other aspect we need to look at, we're doing a county-by-county analysis, and so we need to make sure that we're really comparing apples to apples. So we looked at the 1,600 surface water permits, and from that we removed everything that was imported, coming from outside the county, and was not consumptive, because that doesn't reflect what's truly being consumed. In greater detail, what I mean by that is that if there's surface water being used that originated outside the county, we removed that from the analysis. We wanted to do a balance of the county itself. And so that removal wasn't just entirely the entire permit, but it was treated as a ratio of the upstream contribution to the in-county contribution. Examples of what I'm talking about are the Mississippi River, the Minnesota River, Lake Superior, and so on. So they were removed from the analysis. The other thing we looked at was non-consumptive use. And so we went through each of those permits to see how much of it wasn't truly being consumed, but rather going back to the system. An example would be industries that return much of the water back to the system. Steam power cooling only consumes 2%. So each of those steam water cooling permits, we only counted 2% of it as being consumed. If a source came from groundwater, we did consider that all consumed because it wasn't going back to the original source. So from that, we ended up what we call our net. And that's the baseline. The maps and figures we show you are all based on this net. The gross minus what's imported minus what's not consumed. Then we had to look to the future. Okay, so that's our current. That's our 2005 baseline. What about in the future?
well, everything's done in per capita, so is our use going to increase? Is it going to remain constant, or is it going to decrease? And we had some conversations with Met Council about that, and some of their analysis preliminarily, they were thinking that there'd be a decrease in per capita use due to water use efficiencies. But our data doesn't show it, so after a lot of consideration, we decided to go with a constant. Granted, we could run either scenario to give us kind of thresholds on either side, but we went with a constant for now. And we estimated the 2030 population based on Met Council data and information from the state demographer. So the same thing that we did for 2005, we did for 2030. We calculated the gross use and subtracted the imported waters and non-consumptive. So that's the use side. The other side is supply. And sometimes that can be kind of challenging to figure out. What we did is we looked at published methods of determining supply. There are atlas information for some counties, but much of the state, most of the state doesn't have that information yet, so we need to come up with other ways of estimating how much is there. In some cases, we had to use recharge as a surrogate for sustainable supply if a method gave us recharge information instead of what they call sustainable. Again, all quantified at the county scale. And these different methods do consider a lot of the parameters unique to each county, the soils, the precip, watershed discharge, and so on. So methods that we used, actually one has been referenced today, regional regression recharge method, which Representative Tingelstad has the flyer for, the watershed characteristics method, the net available precip, and fractional precip. So we used these four methods, and they generated five supply values. You'll see the statewide totals from each of these range from 4.1 to 10.7 trillion gallons per year. We're actually happy with the resolution of those different estimates. The USGS method is what we call the triple R method. It was published in January of 06, and it gives you recharge to superficial aquifers. What they gave us for data was the low end and the high end of recharge on a county basis. So that gave us our low and high values. The next one is one that John touched on. It's the University of Minnesota, their watershed characteristics method. And whereas like the recharge method is looking at what's coming into the system, this is a different way of thinking about things. It looks at what comes out of the system. It looks at the system's response. And so it uses factor analysis to correlate many different things, the ecoregion, the soils. It's based on stream flow information. It's quite sophisticated. Then there's the final two methods, net available precipitation and fractional precip. This is based on the theory that precip is the method whereby we can recharge our aquifers and our surface waters. Precip is where everything comes from. So there's a portion of precip that gets back to the groundwater. We touched on that earlier. So what we need to do is consider the uses, the evapotranspiration and other things, and that's what these methods consist of. So the triple R method of USGS gave us the 4.1 and the 10.7, brackets the remaining three. And on the request, what we did is we worked with the remaining three, and county by county, we used the median value for each. So there, we were ready to compare supply and demand. And we defined things as use as a percent of the renewable resource. So 100% would mean that the system's in balance, that the county's using what's being recharged to it annually. So what do we find? Well, here's our statewide map. It's in the report. It's in the handouts. Since most of the interest is in the metro area, we'll kind of zoom in. And what we see is that Ramsey County is at 135%. Four counties use more than 50%. The metro range was 10 to 135. Greater Minnesota was less than 1 to 46. And I just want to say, does this mean that we should be, you know, panicking Ramsey County, they're running out of water? We're not saying that. What we're saying is that we have resources that need to be allocated, and so decisions need to be made. So in this case, Ramsey County could be drawing on the resources of its neighbors, and that can be fine as long as it's a decision that we're making and knowledgeable about. So going out to 2030, how do things change? Again, most of what we see remains in the metro area. Ramsey County has now moved to 177%, but Washington County is expected to see a lot of growth, and so they're up there close to it. Seven counties use more than 50%. The metro range is 23 to 177. Greater Minnesota is less than 1 to 81%. So what does this mean? How can we use this? Well, one way to think about it is our water resources we need to allocate, and we need to understand the impacts of those allocations. So if we look at the median county for Minnesota, what's a typical county look like? Well, it has 716 square miles of area, has about 55,000 million gallons per year of renewable resource available to it. It's currently, in 2005, using about 3.3% of the county's renewable water resource. So say the county's looking at planning. Say it's looking at a new industry coming in or an allocation. All right. So what if this county were going to grow and add a high water using industry to it? Say we call it 750 million gallons a year, just an allocation. Ooh, there. All right, so what does it mean? The 750 million gallons a year is only 1.4% of the current supply. However, it's 41% of what the county is currently using. So it's a huge ratio of what it's using. It also means that that industry would be using all the water in 10 square miles. That means there couldn't be any other users without having conflicts and competing interests. Granted, this is just a rough way of thinking about things. It would assume that water is distributed evenly over the county. We all know that isn't true. But it does provide us a basic tool in terms of putting in perspective what we're talking about. So some of the characteristics of the study. We use the best available information. As John mentioned, it was the first time that this has really been done for the state. DNR Ecological Services did something similar, not quite as rigorous. We did find a high level of agreement in our model predictions, which was good. In every case, we developed the most likely scenario. You know, we didn't go to the thresholds of the most extreme or not. We used median population information. We used median supply information. So the other thing, we didn't include a safety factor. You know, not a lot of analysis is done, including a safety factor. A lot of engineering principles depend on that. We didn't include that in this assessment. And very importantly, this doesn't inform site-specific permitting at all. This is simply, as John mentioned, a way of assessing where we're at and how we're working with our resources. DNR has their entire program designated to the permitting. This isn't for that at all. Now in the future, how do we add to this foundation? This gives us a baseline. But what other things do we really need to consider? Well, everybody's talked about it today. We do need to consider quality. Because in this, we didn't remove contaminated waters. We don't have enough data yet to really do that. We could do it in local levels, but not at the sort of scale we're talking about. The other thing, we did this annually. And so it doesn't look at seasonal fluctuations, monthly fluctuations. It doesn't look at some of those, the needs are greatest during, you know, the summer months. And so we don't have that in this assessment yet. We also didn't look at ecosystems needs, protected surface waters, and so on. The other thing that would be good is we have it at the county scale, which is a great scale. You know, there's 81 watersheds in Minnesota. We get 87 counties. We're to that scale, but sub-county would be really important as well. And with that, I'll pass it back to John.
Well, I don't want you to go too far away from CESA, but the main point is we think of ourselves as being water rich, and this study is actually telling us that, well, we've got a lot of water, but maybe we need to temper that a little bit and stop thinking of ourselves as being water rich. In fact, in the development of the study, one of our state partners concluded that, we've developed all of our water law in Minnesota based on the assumption that we're water rich. And we need to start thinking about how to back up from that a little bit. We've found that real limits exist regionally in the growth corridor. We're starting to get up to those limits. Now, remember, we've backed up the Mississippi River, so that's kind of a safety valve, but it's not unlimited. It's not an unlimited safety valve. And locally throughout the state, even though our study didn't really highlight that, even if it were in a county that's like a 1% to 3% use county right now by our estimations, you can have a serious issue if you plop down a big ethanol plant in the middle of that county. And the 10 square mile factor, which was the median hypothetical Minnesota county, in southwestern Minnesota, we haven't done that calculation. We can do it. We have the data. But, you know, I'm guessing it's going to go to 50 square miles devoted to one purpose in time. So it's just a tool. That's a nice tool for communities to be aware of what they're getting into when they jump on that kind of a bandwagon. Let me just mention a couple of things. In conclusion, well, this is kind of the first assessment, systematic assessment, and we think it lays a strong foundation for future work, and we've defined some areas, as Princesa mentioned, where we can make some improvements on it. We also would like this to become something that we routinely do for you, so that you asked us to take the pulse with DNR of how we're doing on quantity. You've also asked us to take the pulse on quality, and we are going to be beginning a quality trends analysis this year as well. Our partners there are PCA and agriculture, and we would add health to that partnership. But this first consistent, systematic assessment, we want you to get used to it and expect it from us, which is what the state ought to be doing. This is a tool for planning. Communities have to make water commitments. As I think Chris mentioned, in the Northwest Corridor of the metro area, the conjunctive use idea is that, well, you know, as St. Paul now does, we need to actually pair our use of groundwater with surface water, particularly in that quarter or that quadrant. We know that groundwater gets more and more scarce, and you go from three levels of aquifers in Hennepin County to one or spotty as you approach St. Cloud. Fortunately, the Mississippi River is there, but that's a costly resource to tap just for the water supply treatment expenses alone. But this is a tool for us, our exercise is a tool for just us stepping back and thinking about where we're heading, the long-term need tool. And it's we hope it will be an aid in supporting DNR's requests for more information, more resources to collect information on water quantity, as well as the innovative project that the LCCMR has funded at the University of Minnesota on that watershed characteristics model, which is, again, looking at what's coming out of the system and assuming that that's maybe what we can take long term. And one thing I do want to mention, kind of as an aside, the state has supported the County Geologic Atlas, and it's a marvelous tool. It's a crucial building block in this whole package, but it doesn't get all the information we need for quantity. And they define the basins, and they define where the water is, and how vulnerable it is to contamination, very important things, and first step things. But we need to know how much you can pull out of that system without screwing up the system, and those do not tell you that. So a whole new block of work is needed on top of those county geologic atlases, whether it happens at the county scale or an aquifer system scale or whatever that remains to be seen. But there's an opportunity there for more focus on that. And something that Jim Japs would tell you if he were up here too, and maybe you'll hear from him in another hearing, DNR is working with local water utilities and asking them to look at sustainability, the supply-demand question locally. We would like to help them do that, but we don't have the ammunition right now to do that very effectively. But that's also an important thing for you to be aware of. The communities, the utilities are being asked by DNR to look at that, and we need to see how they're doing it and what they're finding as well in that. I thought I would play some more with future water management, and this is kind of going to summarize some of the stuff you've already heard. But you know, a future water management system, we would put water up front in land use decisions. Right now it's at the back end. The land use is already developed half the time, and then we figure out, oh, do we have enough water in that well, and we do pumping tests, and then, you know, all this stuff. It's kind of an ass-backwards way to do that, if you forgive my French. But we need to put water up front in land use decisions and integrate them, that consideration, into land use decisions. Whether they're strictly local decisions or whether they're preempted and prompted by state agency grants or whatever, or building roads or whatever. We need to do this more effectively. We need to manage aquifers as a whole system and watersheds, and then both together, because they are all interrelated. And what we do on watersheds ends up in aquifers as well. So as one, recognizing that's a theme you've heard from all the speakers, I think. We need to be well-informed, and that goes to quality as well as quantity issues. And we have a long way to go. We've set an agenda on clean water legacy, and it's not strictly cleanup, but it's, even though it's primarily cleanup of the state's impaired waters, we need to do something analogous on quantity and availability. And it would probably not cost as much. I'm confident it would not cost as much. It might be 5% of the cost of clean water, of the surface water. And by the way, clean water legacy, as we know, is surface water quality. We aren't thinking about groundwater quality in it. That's because EPA is focusing on surface water, so we follow in their mold and focus on surface water ourselves. Well, we need to focus on groundwater quality and how to deal with it, and on quantity. And we can do it fairly economically. We need to accept limits to growth, and we've talked about that. That chemical society and precautionary principle is a profound conversation for this state to be having, and we need to be having that. And that's all by way of saying we need to meet ecosystem needs, community needs, and business needs for the future. And we said all these things 35 years ago in the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act. It's kind of sobering to look at that and how current that policy statement that you adopted really is today. Not literally. I don't want to hazard a guess, Mr. Chairman, where you were in 1973.
But it was in kindergarten.
Okay. but this continuing policy to create and maintain conditions under which human beings and nature can exist in productive harmony, that's actually everybody's policy in this state. And how many of us have forgotten about that? And it's the message I have. And finally, a sustainable community does not undermine its economic, environmental, or social health, or that of other communities. And with that, Prince Jason, I stand for any questions you might have.
Questions, Representative Clark.
I have one that came up when you were talking about the commissioners that are involved with the EQB. Minnesota Housing Finance Agency isn't on there currently. Have they ever been on there?
No. In fact, interesting that you should mention that. I'm involved with a Sustainable Investment Alliance group, and that's just an informal name we've given ourselves, working at with partners at the McKnight Foundation. It's chaired by Warren Hansen of the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, and we're very focused on land use and its effect on resources. And actually, the legislature, they thought they had gotten a bill adopted by you guys last session to establish a sustainable, I didn't quite like the name, but a sustainable growth working group to look at these issues, to look at how what the state's putting, but the money we transfer to local government, how does that deal with, how does that affect land use? The old term was smart growth, whether it's popular or not. And we aren't looking at that right now. And we're going to actually, that's going to come back again next session, I will tell you. It may be tweaked by climate change issues. But one of the most important things we can do to reduce global warming gases is to be more compact in our development. But housing, and on EQB, they're actually asking that question too, because I'm making this argument that EQB ought to be getting explicitly involved in climate change. And they're saying, well, what about housing?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
Yeah, if you could help us with that, I'd really like to see that, because we were talking yesterday again about the residential use and how we need to ask for responsibility at all those different levels. And if the cost of, for example, building housing developments is not, if they don't figure in at the cost of the water that's being used and contaminated and whatever, mm-hmm. Diverted, it isn't taking the whole picture into account. So maybe we could work on that together, expanding the EQB to include the Commissioner of Housing. And then I would be very interested. I'm the chair of the committee that deals with housing, and I'd be interested, along with my colleague who's also on that committee, who's at the table here, to maybe see what we might do for in terms of incentives or disincentives to deal with that kind of land use question around rapid housing development in areas where there's the water is in jeopardy. Maybe you could help us. I'd be interested in your advice.
Okay. One thing I didn't mention, if I can just, I know you want to move on, but if our numbers are close on the 135% on Ramsey County or 177 for Ramsey in 25 years, what do we do about that? What does that mean? Does that imply that we need to rethink how we regulate the appropriation of water in the state? And maybe it implies that we ought to put a dollar value on it so that it becomes more efficient in its use. But it might imply a whole lot of things that we have just begun to think about, and I just wanted to mention that. Thank you.
Representative Wiginius.
Thank you. I appreciate this beginning foundation information. I wanted to ask you about when we went through the maps fairly quickly. One of the maps that surprised me, that in the far southwest, it didn't show up as a water-poor area, yet we are spending tons of money to import water from the Missouri River. How does that show up? I mean, it way out of the state of Minnesota. How does that show up way down in those southwest counties? We have this... We've undertaken a huge project with the Lewis and Clark Water. So help me out here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Levine, the balance that we did, the best we could, looked at incoming to the large surface area of those counties
and then looked at the use in the county, and the populations are small. We're talking about maybe 5,000 people. And so unfortunately, our analysis in this situation doesn't allow us to see those sub-county problems. It's simply looking at the water balance and the use. When you have 5,000 people, you have such few people for the use of what's in the county, but it doesn't mean it's where it needs to be, and it doesn't mean that it can always be saved throughout the year for when it's needed, if that helps to answer the question. So we all agree that it doesn't reflect the problems of that area as much as we'd like it to.
Yeah, somehow that's what I think we need to add, because I'm looking at the huge amounts of money that are being expended on that project. And then we, Representative Tingle said, and I were on the bonding tour in this just this last week, the part of the, oh, you were on this bonding tour too.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Scalzi was there too, she's vice chair of the committee. We were in the Granite Falls area, and we heard a presentation from the local Native American community that was looking for water, could not find it, and had done a lot of water research themselves, and was coming to us asking for bonding money for to do well drilling outside of what they would normally see as their area in order to get water to go into the community. And right down the road, they didn't have enough water. Right down the road, we had permitted Granite Falls ethanol. And so something is not right, because we are going to be spent. I assume we will appropriate some money, bonding money.
But would it be fair to say that this aggregate level mapping won't tell you about well interference of a particular?
That's correct.
Large user, for example.
For sure, and that's why we, Princesa mentioned that this doesn't directly inform individual permitting decisions that DNR has to make. It should color those decisions. But I have to say, even our projections for 2030, you don't project, the way our methodology was just to drive it off of population. We were going to try to be more sophisticated in that, and we ran into methodological problems. But it would be very difficult to say, to project whether an ethanol plant is going to plop down in a county. And I suppose if you focus on the ethanol industry, you might be able to do that a little more effectively, but we certainly didn't do that. So those numbers don't reflect any unexpected heavy water users ending up in a county, which is why we added that land area statistic, or just to help people understand that there's another way of thinking about water, and that's to think about it in a land context, which is kind of suitable since we have a riparian doctrine of water law.
Okay. If I could, Mr. Chair, follow up?
Representative Bouguinis.
Yes. Well, DNR has maps now of, we received them yesterday in the bull committee, ethanol plants that are in permitting process, and the numbers just going like this. So it seems to me it might be easy to add that, because it's real data.
That's a good point. Thank you.
Let's see. Representative Tingleston and then Representative Bankenmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a quick comment and then three quick questions. First of all, my comment is thank you for putting this report together. I think this is the third time I've heard it presented between LCCMR and Environment Committee, and each time I learn more things and understand more. So thank you. And, you know, as legislators, we get hundreds of reports a year and in our term in the legislature, and I would say that this is the most important report that I've seen in my 11 years in the legislature, and kind of the long-term impact that it can have for our state. So I wish we could get every member of the legislature in here to understand these issues, because this may be one of the most important things that we do during our tenure in the legislature. So thank you for that. And I was just going to mention, I hope you never retire, because we need you. So thank you. And I'm glad to see Ms. Van Buren, too, kind of, you know, taking over some of the issues here. Yes, thank you. So my three very specific questions. First, to Ms. Van Buren, in your analysis where you talk about water use in a typical county, so would that be a typical metro, greater Minnesota, overall Minnesota? Kind of what are you calling typical as far as square miles and all that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tingle said, it was based on the median value for each of the parameters of the state. And so just looking at all 87 counties, what was the median area, the median renewable resource, the median use information.
Okay, so to follow up then, if you were to do that just for the metro county, those numbers would be very different.
They'd be very different. You know, Ramsey County is a much smaller area but has a lot of use. The renewable water supplies are greater per area in the metro. These are definitely analyses we could do if there was something specific that you were looking for. We'd be happy to provide it.
Okay. My goal is to have us have that on our website so that somebody can come in and hit some buttons and make that quick calculation. And we should be able to do it in the next couple of months, I believe.
Good. So, Mr. Chair, my next question then is, with the LCCMR, we're doing the statewide conservation plan, and the University of Minnesota is coordinating that. I just want to make sure that you're involved in one of those subcommittee groups.
I am involved in that, and I was involved in phase one and brought this report to their attention. And so, yes. Although EQB has this major responsibility to look at things cutting across lines, and we have five people to do it, so it's kind of we have to be focused on what we do. The LCCMR also has funded, I think I mentioned that, the extension of that watershed characteristics, University of Minnesota method that we use for that one supply side. And you've recommended, I believe, funding the energy and water, maybe that's water balancing you were talking about, with Laura Schmidt and others, which will actually help us do the next, 2 years from now or 3 years from now, the next supply-demand analysis. We should be able to get a lot of better information, more precise information on projected demands to add to our equation.
Okay, and then my last question. The first time I saw this presentation, I went to my Anoka County people and I said, do you know about this? And they had no idea. And so I said, well, who is the person within the county government structure that I can talk to about more detail? And they had a lot of trouble finding a person, and actually I'm glad to see that Dakota County has this full-time person that works on education, but where they pointed me to in Anoka County was the Soil and Water Conservation District, and certainly, they deal with water issues, but I think it's totally different, and so my question to you is, how do you get to the implementation level, the point of dealing with local city officials that are maybe on the Planning and Zoning Committee that maybe approve this business or this new development? How do you give them the specific information in their day-to-day decision-making so that they can use this information wisely?
Well, the one thing that I just mentioned, posting that one, that land area equivalent of any new appropriation on our web and making it user-friendly would be one small way to do that. But how do we reach out to 87 counties is a really hard thing to contemplate at this point in time. Mm-hmm. So it's a good question, and actually there are other ways, like speaking at annual meetings and so forth. We're just starting, even though this report has been out since April, we've been involved with three different presentations, and next week I'm presenting in New Mexico, which is another story, but on this very subject, there is national interest in what we've done. When I get back, we're going to be presenting to the Pollution Control Agency board, because they have some citizen members who, in particular, who are very concerned about all the ethanol plants that come by their doorstep, and they don't feel they have a framework within which to consider their approval. Ours will give a kind of a perspective, but it's still not windowed in enough to make those specific decisions. How we bridge the global picture that we're presenting here with the on-the-ground decisions is the challenge we all face, and that has to happen. Those have to come together. They're not unrelated. They have to come together, and we are trying to figure out how to make that happen. I think the stuff the LCCMR is funding is a beginning way to start both the one they're doing right now as well as the future one that we hope the legislature will confirm next session. That'll be a major help in building that bridge, but more needs to be thought of in that area too.
I encourage you to pursue that some more. Thank you.
Thanks.
Say hello to Governor Richardson for me when you go
there. Will he be in state? I don't know.
Maybe closer than we think.
Thanks.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just had a follow-up question to Representative Wagenius's. I don't understand your, like, one of your last slides that showed the low percentage of water used in southwestern Minnesota, would you not be taking, is it because you don't take into account the quality of the water? Because those folks do not have water down there, period. They can't drill for it. They're not having businesses locate there because they don't have water. I don't understand how you're showing percentages in single digit of their available water being used. I'm wondering, if you don't have the answer, could you get it to us? Just so I'm trying to understand what this is.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara. Again, we did this based on the assumption that supply was distributed evenly over the county. We didn't have the data to say where supply was and wasn't located. So that means that when you have a population base that's concentrated in a single area, or if you have a number of higher water users concentrated in a single area, it won't work because they can't draw physically from 10 or 50 square miles. And so we don't have the...
It's about a 4 or 5 county wide problem. It's
I know. Not,
so I don't understand. I don't want to take all your time here, but it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's that whole corner includes 4 or 5 counties. They don't have any water anywhere in the county unless I'm completely out of line. My understanding is that part that is on the Missouri, it's 5 counties. If you could just, the numbers don't jive. They don't have any water, period. Unless the quality is the issue. They have maybe shallow wells that are poor quality and they can't drink it.
I believe that it's both. I believe we didn't factor in quality. We didn't have that information either. Quality is part of it. The quantity may exist, but again, in localized areas and not sufficient for larger populations. Or industries, either way. Again, that is one of the big limits of this study. We aren't able to show the conflicts that exist down there, that we all know exist down there. The conflicts also exist because we just don't have enough information about where those resources are.
And the other thing is, some of our information was what's coming into the system, recharge, like some rules of thumb. The fractional precipitation is saying 20% of the rainfall. But, you know, it's based on what's actually on the ground with precipitation and so forth. So it is a mystery. Why didn't that? We expected that to show up, but this is what the data says. So we're just telling what the data says, and that actually is the USGS thing. The brown areas in the USGS, that's their lowest recharge areas of the state, and
it's 5 to 10 inches of recharge, or centimeters, excuse me. So you're talking in the neighborhood of 1.25 to 2.5, and that's what they are estimating as being recharge. Chris had mentioned, I believe, 2.5 inches. Help me with that, flooding the metro, being sufficient for the metro. So again, there's definitely a disconnect between what we're seeing for recharge and how it's available. We haven't focused on that area. We definitely could try to get more information on that.
And one other thing, it says, take note, recharge to surficial material, so stuff getting into the dirt. That doesn't mean it ends up falling into or drifting into an aquifer. That is actually harvestable. And that is probably what's happening a lot in there. It also might be in the surficial materials which then go out into the streams, which would be counted in our estimate as being available for use, whether you can actually economically harvest it or not, and whether it's in the places you want it or not. So that's what's happening there. But low population, normally low baseline of demand, but also the water's not where you think it is, or you may not know where it is. It may be in areas you don't find, we're not aware of in those counties because we haven't studied them thoroughly. So all that stuff is happening to make those what look like hard to explain lower numbers in southwestern Minnesota. The only way we had around that to emphasize that this may not paint the full picture there is that land area equivalent of new appropriations for local planners to think about.
Representative Virginius.
Thank you. I would agree with Representative McNamara's concerns. Similarly, in northeast Minnesota, there's virtually no groundwater. And maybe there are some maps available that would be just helpful in your presentation, because I see what you're trying to get at, but there's also other information available that gives the picture of where water is. And I think that's the helpful piece.
I think next time we do this, we would like to supplement the statewide scan, if you would, with windowing in on individual communities or individual counties to show a different perspective or to highlight that. And that's one way we can get at that that issue.
And Representative Scalzi had a
question. My comments are along the line of Representative Lucchini's. This map is hard for me to read. I would like to get another one that I could look at. And even in your small handout, it's hard for me to understand what it says. But I did want to just follow up again on her other comment about the Lewis and Clark Water Project, because you had said before you were looking at maybe 5,000 people in that area. But when we look at this Lewis and Clark Water Project, which has already been funded by some other states, I mean, we haven't done it to the extent that they need yet, but it's already, it's being dug, and these are pipes like, and I think they're 4-foot diameter, or are they 5-foot diameter? So this is a huge amount of water that can go through those pipes. And I think that they're thinking it's going to be more than 5,000 people in the future, so it's something that your board should certainly be looking at, because this is a massive project. It's amazing when you look at the pictures of it.
Representative Wiggins.
Thank you. It's also a good idea to show the costs of not having water and having to do this huge project.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We have been talking about some other hearings before the session starts in February. We don't have any specific dates, but we'll troll the waters to see about availability and so on. And comments are always welcome from stakeholders, too. It would be appreciated. Seeing no other questions or comments, this meeting is adjourned.